Today we're going to talk about the second part of the H201. We got through the first five sections. There are 15 sections in it, so we have a bunch to cover, but quite a bit goes faster in this second session, so I'm not too concerned about what we need to get through. And as I said, this and the B101 will be the most important documents you guys will be using, because you'll see these terms and conditions in almost every contract. Something similar to that that you guys will ever take a look at or have to help an assistant owner out on. So let me pull that up. And then move this out of the way. And I'll keep watching for people to pop in. So we're going to start now with Article 6. So, as you can imagine, in the construction projects, and I've used this example numerous times when we have this hotel and you want to bring in your separate special designer for the cool restaurant, sometimes you also want to bring in a separate special contractor. So the owner is going to bring in what's called separate contractors or separate subcontractors. The owner's contractors, you know, I had a project where... Why is this not moving? There we go. I had a project where the owner was a very high-end residential home, and a very, very good contractor, but the owner had a relationship with a friendly relationship with an owner of a slate shingle roof system. So, like, you know, there's your regular asphalt shingles that most people have in their house, but for the higher end houses, they'll put a slate roof on. And so they wanted to use that slate roofing contractor. So that was a separate contractor. And there actually was interesting things in that agreement, because the contractor that was building the home was a union contractor. So all of their workers and all the subcontractors that this contractor retained were union workers. The owner wanted to bring in a non-union slate roofing contractor. So not only was there a family or a familiar relationship with this contractor, but there was going to be a price savings, because union is often more expensive. You also get what you pay for. When you bring in union contractors, you get better work. More often than not, not always, but often. So we had to both address issues in this provision, this section of the contract, separate contractors, and we also had to address issues of whether the general contractor as a union could work with non-union subcontractors. Sometimes you'll find on a project that the union workers won't show up if there are non-unions, because even though it's not the same union, so like a plumber or an electrician in a union won't go to the project, even though it's the roofing contractor that's non-union, because they want to protect all the union work. So there had to be negotiations about that. So it can have, when the owner brings in their own separate contractor, it can have ramifications outside of just what the obligations are of that separate contractor. So under here, under 611, it's just a definitional term of what a separate contractor. And so the owners reserve the right to perform constructions or operations related to the project with the owner's own forces. And really what you're saying here, you want to make sure, like I said, in many of your construction contracts, but certainly with the AIA, sometimes it's pretty obvious, but it helps to state the obvious. So you want to think about it. It's the owner's project. Yes, the owner's hired the contractor. But the owner wants to say, hey, if there's a chance that I want to bring in my own team, I have the right to do that, and you can't object. And so you get that agreement of the owner reserved the right. You get that agreement underway in the beginning, before you even bring somebody in. The example I was just talking about with the roofing contractor, that was known from the beginning. So those discussions happened right away. It was a very, very large home, so the roofing contract was about $500,000. And so that was known from the beginning. But sometimes you don't know. Sometimes you're moving along, and there may be a design issue that comes up that you say, well, I'm better off if I bring in my own separate contractor. What you don't want to do is, at that point, then go to the contractor and say, hey, I'm bringing somebody else in to do this work that you thought you were going to do. And then you get into discussions about, well, what was really the deal? So here, you at the very beginning, you agree to up front. If I want to, you can object to the contractor. So, now, when you bring in your own separate contractor, there's got to be coordination between the work that's being done by the general contractor and the work that's being done by the separate contractor. And so the question is who's responsible for that coordination? I mean, as far as when the parties are going to be on project site, who's going to be responsible for making payments? How do those different pieces interface? So if we go back to the example of the high-end restaurant at the hotel, the contractor is going to build out the space and have all the connection points for the HVAC and the mechanic, the electrical and the plumbing and whatever else you need to have. And they're going to follow the drawings that the architect prepared. Well, there still may need to be interfaces between when the specialty kitchen contractor comes in and how they relate with the HVAC contractor or subcontractor for the general contractor. So the question is who's responsible for those coordinating and interfaces? But in here, the way the AIA has written it, it says it's the owner. I mean, and it's somewhat logical. You want to bring somebody in? Well, then you got to make sure that it's coordinated. And so you are that responsible for that. Now, what I will tell you as a side, when I represent an owner and they're going to bring in separate contractors, unless there is something proprietary, there's some intellectual property issues or otherwise, I will change this. From the owner shall provide for coordination, I will put that on the contractor, and I will do it in the beginning. The reason being is the contractor is the one who's in charge of the overall project and the overall schedule. And if you are in a situation where the owner is now responsible for adjusting the schedule or adjusting what happens in the course of the project, and something goes wrong, the contractor is immediately going to say, no problem. So they're going to step away, the contractor. They're going to say, I didn't have anything to do with that. And they're going to point to this provision, 6.1.3. Now, if you tell them in the beginning that the contractor is responsible for the owner's separate contractors, then they grumble a little bit because they say, well, I don't have any authority over them. You're the one that has the contract with them, so how can I have the authority? So there's other language I include that talks about what the owner still needs to do in cooperating with the contractor, but you want to still have the control of the schedule and what happens on the project site still in the hands of the contractor. But the AIA, based on discussions, and I think I've told you guys that the AIA, when it's created, there's proponents for architects, contractors, subcontractors, consultants, owners, everybody under the sun has language in here. And this is one where the contractor pushed back strong enough and said, we don't want the responsibility. If the owner wants to bring somebody in, that's fine, but they have to own everything that they're parties that they're bringing in. It does include, so that's the pushback to the first part of this provision. But then the flip side is, so the owner got a little bit back in, and so the contractor shall make any revisions to its construction schedule deemed necessary after joint mutual review. So contractor says, you're a separate contractor, you're responsible. Owner says, okay, I'll take that responsibility, but you need to meet with me, and if there's a schedule impact, then you need to make sure your schedule addresses that. So that's what's happening in this provision. It's the kind of the yin and the yang. I'll give you another kind of real-world example. I have... Everything keeps dropping for me today. Okay. I have a case right now in litigation, another resident, different client, and I was not involved in any of the initial contracts. And in that project, the contractor bid out certain scopes of work, and there were other scopes of work that the architect, for whatever reason, believed it was better that the architect and or the owner would enter into agreements with these separate contractors. So in one instance, this is a very high-end residential project. In one instance, the architect felt all of the wood floors and all of the stone, you know, the tile and the countertop stone and everything else, because they are finishes, so they had an aesthetic quality to them. The architect felt it was important in this high-end home that the architect and the owner had the selection and the ability to bring in the right wood and the right stone. Now, it was just for materials. It was not for the installation, but it was related to the materials. But what ended up happening was there was no language like we see here that placed responsibility for the coordination of the work that moved it from the owner to the contractor. And as the materials came in, the architect facilitated the purchase of the materials, but did nothing more, because architects aren't responsible, as you guys know, for means and methods. And the architect thought that was fine. But the problem was the contractor also did nothing more because of this clause that says the coordination responsibilities are the responsibility of the owner. But we wondered if he was just a homeowner. So they had no idea. They weren't there coming and looking at the wood and looking at the stone and looking at the tile. So the contractor just installed what was in front of them. And nobody was, you know, like, nobody was watching the work that was being done. Nobody was checking to make sure that the stone was right, that it fit correctly, that it was measured. And so now this house has all of these problems because the contractor, probably correctly, but we'll have to wait and see as the litigation goes on, said, hey, not my problem. Look at this provision. And the owner had no idea there was this provision. And the architect said, well, I don't do means and methods, so I don't have to worry about this. So we have a gap. So what I try to do, as I said, on this provision, is I try to close that gap and keep it all into one-stop shopping. I like if the contractor takes care of them, if you're representing an owner. And I think you guys want to make sure you think about at least having that discussion with your owner clients. Because you, with the architect, like in this case, I think the architect may have some responsibility here, because they were the ones that pushed for these aesthetic materials to flow through the owner, but didn't do anything to instruct the owner that they had to do more to coordinate the activities. So you want to make sure, as you, as the architect, when you're talking about the owner, that if there is something that's special, say, okay, we can bring in a separate contractor for that. That may be something you want to think about as you advise your owner. But we need to make sure who's responsible for that separate contractor. And that goes back to this Article 6.1.3. Okay. 6.1.4 basically says the owner and its separate contractor shall have the same obligations and rights that the contractor has under the conditions of the contract. Basically what this says is this is kind of an affirmation of the contractor. Here are all the terms and conditions contracted that you must follow. You need to abide by all these rules. We're playing Monopoly, as I always use as an example. This provision also says, unless somewhere in this contract and the related documents, if the owner's bringing a separate contract, they too must play by the same rules of Monopoly. This is just basically saying, if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. If I, as the general contractor, have to follow these rules, owner, your separate contractor has to follow these rules. We don't want to have two separate rules on how to play the game. Again, it's logical, but I will tell you this. I had I'm negotiating a contract that I was looking at last night, and the contract itself is not as clear. It doesn't have this provision. It's a contract that's a very well-written document, and it has many provisions that are, as I read them, I'm like, this is almost word for word from the AIA document. But it doesn't have this one. And so, correctly and astutely, the contractor wrote back in its comments, it says, we're fine with separate contractors, but they need to follow the rules of this agreement. And it was because this provision was missing. So, these things come up all the time, and it's important, again, we all stay in the same rules to the Monopoly game. 6.2. Contract error of mutual responsibility. Contractor shall afford the owner and separate contractors a reasonable opportunity for introduction and storage of the materials and equipment, and so forth and so on. What this is basically saying is the owner says to the contractor, look, you're on site and you have your subs, and your subcontractors are going to have spots for their lay down. They're going to have spots where they're going to put their trailer. Whatever they're going to do, you are going to give them that storage area for the, so they can do their work properly. I, as the owner, yes, I'm going to bring in my own separate contractors, but you need to be nice to them. You need to let them play in the sandbox as well. So this is a saying, look, we're all in this together, and so you need to coordinate. So part of that, and that's part of that coordination issue. And this is why you want to put it on the contractor. Because if not, a contractor could argue, well, they get to put the trailer, but owner, you have to find out where that trailer goes. And if there's not enough space in the land, well, that's tough because you're responsible for coordination. So this is a mutual responsibility issue on 6.2. 6.2.2, if the part of the contractor's works depends on the proper execution or the results or construction operations by the separate contractor, contractor shall, prior to proceeding with that portion of the work, promptly notify the architect of apparent discrepancies or defects in the constructions or operations by the owner separate contractor. So what this is saying is, contractor, before you, if you have to go into the work in an area that a separate contractor has already done some stuff, before you start working, you got to take a look around. And if you see something wrong, and it says apparent discrepancies or defects, if you see something wrong, you got to let us know. And then we can go back to our separate contractor and tell them to fix. The last sentence here says the contractor should not be responsible for the discrepancies or defects that are not apparent. So it's saying, if you can't see it, it's not your fault. You're not going to have to do, you're not going to have to look under the hood. You're not going to have to look deeper into it. But if it's apparent when you're looking at it, if you can notice it, if you can recognize it in what a normal contractor would do, then you have an obligation to raise it. And this is important because let's say that the separate contractors installed some electrical work, some specialty electrical work. And then the contractor, the general contractor, brings in its regular electrician, and they're installing lighting fixtures. And if it's apparent that the specialty electrical work done by the specialty contractor was wrong, that the subcontractor goes ahead and installs those lights, if it was apparent, the contractor can't come back and say, well, we have to rip everything out, and somebody has to pay me for it. No, the owner says, you had an opportunity to see, you should have seen this, you didn't raise it to me, so therefore, it's your fault, not that the work was done improperly by the separate contractor, we'll have to deal with them, but to rip out the work that your electrician did, to remove those lights, then we'll bring our separate contractor back in to fix what it screwed up, and then put in the new lights, and related to that, obviously, would be a schedule delay, because we're moving along, but now we got to stop, rip work out, fix, rework, everything else. Those schedule delays also likely would fall on the contractor, the general contractor, as opposed to the separate contractor, if such defects or discrepancies were apparent. So that's what 6.2.2 says. Contractors should reimburse owners for costs that incurred if there's a related to a delay. So I was just talking about delay. So if there's something that goes wrong, maybe the delay in this instance was that we just as an example was the contractor saw something, didn't raise their hand, and there's a delay to fixing it because of that. That's the contractor's fault, and costs related to those delays should be reimbursed to the owner. Or the opposite would be, let's say that the space where that specialty kitchen was going to go in needed to be ready by such and such a date, January 1st, and I brought my specialty contractor and their trades in to start working January 1st, and if that kitchen area isn't ready and available until January 20th, well, I got to pay my separate contractor to sit around for 20 days, and during that 20-day period of time, that costs me money, and that delay is a result of the contractor. So the contractor needs to pay me for those delays. The flip side is, if the owner causes delays, the owner shall reimburse the contractor. So if my guy causes the contractor to sit around and wait, that's my responsibility as the owner, and I have to pay the contractor for those delay costs. So, again, a mutual fairness in who has to pay for what. This just talks about owners' right to clean up. They at least have access to the site to clean up their separate contractors in 6.3. That's really all you need to know about Article 6 of what the separate contractors. Any questions when you bring in that third party, how the contract here lays out the responsibilities? Okay, good. All right, Article 7, changes in the work. Now, this is one of the more important sections of the contract for a couple of reasons. One, and I may have said this and I haven't, this is very true. There is rarely, if ever, any construction project that does not have a change order. And a change order is something that happens. We all agree to what the cost of the project is, what the schedule of the project is, and what is supposed to be built based on the drawings and specifications. And invariably, when you get in and you start working, there's a change. Maybe it's because you didn't realize the soils were bad. Maybe it's because the owner wants to add another bathroom. Maybe it's because there's just something that changes in the code. Whatever happens, because the drawings that are prepared, drawings and specifications, are never 100% because it just would be too arduous to do that. There's always going to be a change order. So it's important, this provision, because it's going to come up in every project you ever work on. So you need to understand how the change order process works. It's also important here because it walks through that there are different types of change orders. So there's what's called a minor change, there's a construction change directive, and there's the change order. And every one of these is a modification to the agreement, but it doesn't invalidate the agreement. Think about it this way. If you remember when we talked about in the first part of the semester in the world, in the concept of offer and acceptance. So I make an offer for you that I'm going to design your house for $50,000. And you come back to me and say, I will pay you $45,000 for that offer, to design the house. That's a counteroffer. And that initiation of the counteroffer immediately vitiates or voids the $50,000 offer. The $50,000 offer is no longer on the table. And so you can't say, oh, we agreed to 50. It's either 45 or some other agreement. Now, you could have a counter offer that brings the 50 back in, but the point being is that a deviation or a change in the beginning, so when the offer and acceptance aren't mirrored, voids the initial discussion. But what 7.1.1 says is you can have, after the execution of the contract, and without invalidating the contract. So here what we're saying is we can have changes later. We're all agreement, but this is kind of a separate type of change to the agreement that doesn't void the rest of it. We can add a bathroom without tossing out the whole contract. That's what a change order, constructive change directive, sometimes called a CCD, that's what this allows to have happen. So that's the process that makes change orders different than the whole basic concept of contract drafting. But important, because it makes no sense if you want to add a bathroom to your house that you have to renegotiate the whole agreement. That just makes no sense. So that's why construction allows this concept of change orders and so forth. So 7.1.2 says it's based on an agreement between the owner, contractor, and the architect. So that's the change order. It has to have all three, owner, contractor, and architect, for a change order. The constructive change directive, or CCD, requires an agreement by the owner and architect and may or may not be agreed by the contractor. So the CCD only requires two of the three. And then the order for a minor change may be issued by the architect alone. So there's a difference between the three types of changes that can happen to the agreement and who has to be a party. So that's something else you've got to remember. And every project will have this same concept. I have an agreement right now. They don't call it a constructive change directive. They call it a provisional change order. And that provisional change order still only requires agreements between the owner and the architect. It doesn't require all three. But they, as we get through the rest of this section, you'll understand why you still want all three. They shouldn't all have to. They're like, but why would we not have all three parties agreeing to it if we want to change something in a project? Well, there's reasons. and it has to do with timing and getting the work done and keeping under schedule while you're trying to figure out the details, so to speak. So 713 says you got to proceed promptly with the change, so you don't want to delay. If there's a change, you want to implement it and keep moving along because time is money and your schedule is important. So let's talk about the most important, the ultimate change order. It's a written instrument, so it needs to be in writing and signed by all three. So you're going to have a change order form, and often what I do when I draft my contracts is I attach, here is the exact form that I want everybody to use. So we don't say it was through an email. We don't say it was through, you know, some letter that I wrote. It's an actual form. It has the information that you need in it, and it's signed by everybody. And the information contains three things at the very least. What the change of the work is, so a description of what you're changing. The second, the amount of time, of the sum. How much is it going to cost? Is it going to cost the project more? Or are you eliminating? Maybe you're eliminating a bathroom, and therefore the price goes down. So is there an adjustment in the contract sum? There are also times when there's what's called a no-cost change order. So it is a change in the work, but the contractor says it's going to cost the exact same amount. So we're just going to change number one, but you would identify that this is a zero-cost change order. So you still have to put that information in. And then three is, will it impact the time? Will there be a schedule change as a result of this change order? So that's the three things that must be in writing and must be signed by all three parties. The constructive change directive is also in writing and frequently is prepared by the architect. Sometimes it could be paired by an owner's representative if there's a third party out there, but most of the time it's by the architect. And it's signed by the owner and the architect. Now, it happens, if you see here, directing a change of the work prior to agreement, on the adjustment, if any, of the contract sum or the contract time or both. So here's where this comes into play. You're working as a contractor building my house, and I come to my architect first and I say, we want to add a bathroom. So the architect draws it up, and they go to the contractor and they say, we need to add this bathroom into the project. And the contractor says, I'm in the process of pouring my concrete pad and I need to make sure, because it's a basement bathroom, I need to make sure that I have my plumbing in there. So give me the drawings, but I need to go out and have this priced. I come back with a price, and the architect says, oh my gosh, that is way, way, way too expensive. That's not right. So we are not in agreement. The three parties are not in agreement as to the cost to have this change order. So therefore, but the contractor is saying, okay, well, I can go out and reprice it, and I get three more bids, and you guys, we can haggle about it, but I have to stop the work because I need to get the plumbing in the ground so I can pour the pad, and the pipes have to be in the pad. So that you guys can't, we can't wait. So, or if you want to wait, that's your issue, because you're the one initiating the change order, and you can just pay me for the delay, because it's your issue, not mine. So in that instance, the contractor says, the architect and the owner say, well, we need the work done, and we don't want to slow down the project. The owner says, I know that there's an issue with price, and we can work that out. Let's figure that out later. But let's issue the CCD. Two of us will sign it, saying, we agree on the scope, we agree that you need to move forward, we don't agree on the price. And then we haggle about the price later. So that's what happens in a CCD. Eventually, as you move along, so it also says in 732, constructive change directive should be used in absence of a total agreement of the change order. And it should provide for an adjustment of the contract sum, it should be based on one of the following. So sometimes what you'll put in the CCD is say, we can't agree on the price, but let's agree on the process by which the price will be determined. Maybe it's by lump sum agreement, that's 37331. Maybe it's by unit prices. So unit prices could be, what we're going to do is we're tuck pointing the building, one side of the building. As we're moving along, it's determined that there needs to be more of the building tuck pointed, so we have to figure out a unit price for the cost of those bricks. We'll figure out those unit prices. Each brick has a separate price for tuck pointing. That's what unit prices is. Cost will be determined later by the parties or as provided in 734, which we'll get there in a second. So there's different ways that, so while we're saying in the CCD, we agree in the scope, we don't agree in the price, but let's maybe agree to the method by which we're going to price it as the work is being performed. So that's 733. 734 is as if the contractor disagrees with all those methods, then the architect shall determine the adjustment on the basis of reasonable expenditure. So now it falls to the architect. And what happens there is that the contractor is basically work on what's called a time and materials basis. So it says the contractor should keep and present in a form as the architect may prescribe an itemized accounting together with the appropriate supporting data. And that should be limited to the following. So cost of labor is 7341. Cost of material supplies and equipment, 7342. Cost of rental, machinery and equipment, premiums for bonds, and field office and individuals that are on the site. So all of those, the architect says to the contractor, look, we haven't figured out a lump sum, we haven't figured out unit price, so I want you to keep track of the time and materials. And when you submit those, I, as the architect, will review those, or if it's an owner's rep or whoever on the owner's side is reviewing the payment request, and I'm going to tell you whether I think these are fair and accurate. And so sometimes this is where you get into a dispute between the parties, because contractor comes back and says, to add that bathroom is $50,000. Architect says, that's way, way too expensive to the owner. It's got to be somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000. So they can't come to any reasonable agreement. So the architect says to the contractor, bill me, time and materials. We'll take a look at it. And as the bills start rolling in, you see it's racking up and racking up, and it's clearly going to go to $40,000 to $50,000. Contractor's going to say, I told you that's my bid, and it was reasonable in the beginning. Architect's going to say, you're padding it. So we get into this process here. And if you can't come to an ultimate agreement, 735 says, if the contractor disagrees with the adjustment, meaning the architect says you're billing too high, then they can claim with a capital C in accordance with Article 15. And Article 15 is how you handle, in this project, in this contract, disputes. So you have this process, CCD, to keep the project moving. Owner and architect agree on the scope. The parties aren't agreeing on the price and the time. You try to figure out a method by which to figure out the price. If they can't agree to it, you go to time and materials. And if you can't agree to how the time and materials are happening, contractor ultimately makes a claim. So that's your steps under the CCD. Does that make sense to you guys? Okay, good. So 735 again, if they would make a claim. 736, upon receipt of the CCD, the contractor shall promptly proceed with the change in the work and advise the architect of contractor's agreement or disagreement with the methods. So promptly proceeding is, again, because you're trying to preserve schedule. Time is money. So that's what 736 says. But it also requires that the contractor has to tell the architect and or the owner of the disagreement and of the payment method. If they're silent, you can make an argument. You never objected to how we were going to do this, contractor, so this is what we're going to pay you. And when you make that claim under Article 15, you may have waived it because 736 says you need to advise me of your disagreement in the method. Now, ultimately, 737 says the constructive change directive signed by the contractor indicates the contractor's agreement. And then what happens is we've agreed to the price, or we've agreed to at least the method of the price. And that may not be signed until a little later down the road. Because remember, the CCD initially is only signed by the owner, the architect. But sometime down the road, presumably the contractor is going to sign the CCD. And upon signature of the CCD, it's now effectively converted to a change order. Because now we have a document that changes the project and all three parties have signed. So that's the process of the CCD. Starts with two, You haggle about where the price of the timing is. You eventually come to an agreement, or it goes automatically to a claim. But when you, if and when you come to an agreement, it converts from a CCD to a change order. That process is universal. Sometimes it's called something different than a CCD. Change order is pretty much a universal term in construction contracts, but the CCD is a little bit different. They like I said, like I have one called a provisional change order. But they all have this process, or should, and they all should have this language that says once all three parties have signed on the dotted line, it automatically becomes a change order. Um, 739 talks about while you're trying to find the final determination of the cost, the contractor may request payment for work completed under CCD, and there could be an interim determination of that payment. So that comes into play when the work that's being changed is significant enough that the contractor is going to be working it over more than one pay period. So let's go back to my bathroom example. It's an extensive bathroom. There's some additional, like some of the materials that need to be purchased for it, the fixtures, whatever else is going to go in. And so the contractor says, we're still trying to figure out the pricing of this. You got some, whatever it is, it's unique. So we haven't figured out the pricing, but I know we need to work on it and keep the work moving so it doesn't blow the schedule. So the contractor goes out and spends money and buys the fixtures or the bathtub and the cool Moen shower system or whatever it might be. You know, goes up to Kohler, Wisconsin at the Great Wall of China and buys this really, like, you know, the $5,000 tub or whatever it might be. The contractor says to the owner, it's still a CCD because I haven't signed off on all of the details. We still haven't come to the price. But I've already spent like $10,000 or $12,000 on buying you this really expensive bathtub and toilet and gold-plated fixtures or whatever they might be. I shouldn't have to carry those costs. So your design says this is what I need to purchase. So even though we haven't agreed to the final price, I still should be able to bill you for interim costs over the next month or two or three, depending on how long it takes us to figure this out. And so this allows the contractor to get paid for its work. The CCD allows the work to be continued, and it gives the parties time to finally come to a determination of what the final cost is. So again, another mechanism to get us from point A to point B about their fights. You don't want to have a contractor say, I'm stopping work simply because you won't pay me. That's the wrong thing to do. You've already told them I want this bathroom with gold-plated fixtures, so you got to pay them for that. But you also don't want the contractor to say, I'm not going to do it until you pay me 100%, because we don't agree with 100%. So the CCD works for both parties, kind of interchangeable. It's about how their rights are protected, cost, schedule, and design. 7310, this is again how it converts. When the owner contractor agree, it should be effective immediately, and the architect will now prepare a change order. So it's written up on a separate form like a CCD, and when everybody agrees, the architect needs to go in and use the change order form, and this is just a simple instruction to say, 7310 is just an instruction. Here's the change order form. Now we've got to convert it to a formal change order. The CCD becomes part of the project record, but it's not an official change to the contract. Only change orders can officially change the contract. And that's what happens. That's why I have to write it up. Any questions on CCDs? The next, the last thing in changes is called minor changes in the work. And here, remember, this is the third one of the three, and it only requires the architect. So the architect may order minor changes in the work that are consistent with the intent of the contract documents and do not involve adjustment in time, contract sum, or contract time. Now, the architect wants to put those in writing, but it doesn't require the parties to sign off on it. So you're walking around the project site, and instead of using Dove White, you use the color Navajo White. It's a minor. It's not going to change the price. It's not going to change the time. You still got to order paint. You still got to paint the room. The architect, they had a conversation with the owner, says, do you mind if we go from Dove White to Navajo White? The owner says, not a problem. So the architect just issues what's called a minor change. Should be in writing. And if there's any issues with it, if it affects the time or money, the contractor has to know, but otherwise it's just a simple minor change. This often does not have a form. It could be just something that's in response to an RFI or anything else. But it should be written somewhere. And the other one of the important things is if it's considered a minor change and the contractor doesn't tell the architect or owner that it affects the contract time or contract money, contract time or contract sum, what it says here in this last part of the sentence is contractor waives any adjustment because they've said it, they failed to do it at the time that the minor change is issued. You can't come back later for a second bite at the apple and say, it did cost me more because Navajo White is more expensive due to the pigment. So my per gallon cost was $2 per gallon more. And so, and there was, big space, 30 gallons. So you have to pay me the extra $60. You can't do that here. You've waived it based on the acceptance of the minor change. Any questions on that? Okay. So that's change orders in Article 7. And there are other provisions that I will from time to time add to Article 7. I will add a 7.5, and that will talk about the value of the markup. So most of the time, change orders relate to the subcontractor's work. We're talking about electrical or plumbing or painting or what have you. And it's the subcontractor that will perform the work. The general contractor typically only has this project superintendent, so whether you're using Dove White or Navajo White, whether you're adding a bathroom or not adding a bathroom, the superintendent that works for the general contractor has their own regular costs. But you want to make sure that we know what the markup is for profit and fee and insurance, how much will be charged by the subcontractor. So the subcontractor may say, that gallon of paint is $30 a gallon, I'm going to have charge you $30 plus 10% because that's how I do a markup. And then the contractor may say, I'm going to take that $33 invoice now, 30 plus 10%, and I'm going to mark it up myself because I have to process it another 10%. So I will often add in Article 7 a description of the values of the markup. So we're not surprised. So when the owner says, let's change this, thinking that it's $30 per gallon increase. And what it turns out is it's not 30, it's 33 plus another 10%. So now we looked up to 36.50 or whatever it is, 36.30. That they say, well, why is this so much more expensive? Well, we've identified what the markups are. And that's what happens as I add those provisions. Not relevant for the exam, not relevant for what's in the basic AIA, but you will often have, I raise this simply because when you're advising an owner and looking through pay applications, you often have discussions about the concept of a markup and what additional fees the contractor or the subcontractor get for the work they perform. Okay. Time. So, as I've said many times, time is money. And so, as a result, we want to make sure that the concept of time and schedule are addressed in the construction contract. And if you're not working on it, just as an aside, if you're working with an owner and you get a contract from a contractor and they say, we want to use this, and you're advising the owner, kind of help them through the construction contracting process, and it's not an AIA, you want to take the concepts that are here in this agreement and make sure that they're in the agreement you're getting from the contractor. So there should be a change order provision in that agreement. There should be a timing provision in that agreement. There should be a separate contractor's provision in the agreement. So you want to make sure that the highlights, these, if we go back one slide. So each one of these articles has a time, this is called time, and each one of the articles has their own headline. You want to make sure that those concepts of the headlines end up in the contracts that you're reviewing when you work with an owner. So time
is the overall time for the projects, including authorized adjustments, to get to substantial completion of the work. So if you see in here, there's various capitalized terms. So contract time is a capitalized term, so it's defined. It becomes a term of art in the agreement. The contract documents, as we established earlier a couple weeks ago, is this list of things: the agreement, the specifications, the drawings, the whatever else is provided. So it's kind of this whole overall grouping of documents, of the contract documents. And then there's this concept called substantial completion. Now we'll cover that in the next Article 9. But substantial completion is when the project is fit for its intended use and purposes. So when we create a schedule for a project, we have our start date, or sometimes called commencement date, and then we have all the activities that happen throughout the course of the project. Here we're going to start digging a hole, then we're going to pour cement in the hole, and then we're going to put in rebar, and then we're going to put in steel, or we'll start the framing, and then we'll put in the floors, and you go from there. You build the house, or you build the factory, or whatever it is. And it has the construction sequential process all the way to, here's the key, you can walk in. And when you have that key and you can walk in and use the building, that's substantial completion. And there's a process we'll talk about in a minute in Article 9, how that gets there. But the contract time that everybody is looking at, that time is money period, is the schedule from the beginning, the commencement, to substantial completion. Now, there's always work done on a project after substantial completion. But for purposes of this contract and every construction contract you're going to have, the time is going to be to substantial completion. Now, I will make one caveat. I said every construction project you're ever going to have, every standard construction project. I just had one last fall, an owner that demanded the contract time be through final completion. It's very rare. And final completion is when every single nook and crack and perfect thing is finished and everything is done and people are walking away and never have to call each other again. It's very rare. It causes a lot more issues about who's responsible for what and the release of payment and everything else. But sometimes, on a rarity, contract time will go through final completion. But I would say in 99.9% of the time, it's just through substantial completion. So, that's 8.1.1. 8.1.3 says the date of substantial completion, so that actual date of when it occurs is the date certified by the architect. So you, when you're out there helping the owner, you're going to be the one that says, I agree that this project is substantially complete. That will be your job in certifying the project. And that's important for you to remember, because when we get to Article 9, you have to figure out what that means. Substantial completion. And can I certify that it's complete? Can I bless? And therefore, the clock stops ticking at the end of the schedule. Okay. 8.2.1. Time limits stated in the contract documents are of the essence of the contract. And the contractor confirms the contract time is a reasonable period for performing the work. So there's two things going on here in 8.2.1. The first is saying time is of the essence, which means if the contractor fails to achieve any of the time limits that are in that project schedule, the contractor is in breach of contract because they are of the essence of the contract. So therefore, if you fail to meet a time frame, you're in breach. Now, often a contractor will try to change this. It says the only key date is substantial completion. As an owner, you want to push back and say, no, I need you to hit certain dates. Like, I want to make sure that the hole in the ground is dug by October 1st, so we don't get into the wet season of the fall or the freezing of the winter. And that would cause problems with the schedule. So I want to make sure that the concrete slab and everything else is done before we have cold weather or otherwise. So that's an important time, and it may be of the essence. There may be other things that happen during the course of the project. I want to make sure that we're at what's called dry-in, meaning the roof's on and the windows are there and the walls are sealed so that we can start bringing materials and equipment in to the interior of the building to have that work continue forward. That could be another important key date. Sometimes if you have a factory, you may be able to want to start up some of the lines before the whole project is completed for various reasons. So that may be another date of when electrical and mechanical and things are done. So that's what 821 is saying, is whatever those time limits are in the contract, any and all of them are of the essence. And the second part is the contractor confirms that these are reasonable time periods. The contract time is reasonable to perform the work. So this is saying, by signing this, I, contractor, agree that my contract term, the contract time to start and do all this work, are reasonable. And then I can't come back and argue and say, oh, no, no, it was way too short. No, you're agreeing right here under 821. And then 822, contractor shall not knowingly, except by agreement of structural owner, commence the work prior to the effective date of insurance. That's a good thing. You don't want to have a contractor on the project site without being insured, or their insurance policy is going to come in effect in a week or two. That's because if something goes wrong, the owner needs to have the protection that the insurance is there. So simple kind of concept. 823, the contractor shall proceed expeditiously and with adequate forces and shall achieve substantial completion with the contract time. So even though we have 821 that says all the time are of the essence, we kind of add an extra layer of protection here that says we're going to bring the right people, you're going to work on it expeditiously, and you shall achieve substantial completion within the contract time. So this is, if they fail to do this, they clearly are in breach of contract. There could be arguments up in 821 as to what is really important and not important, but certainly this 823 says substantial completion is paramount. You must achieve that within the contract time. And then the last part that's in this document with respect to 8.3 is 8.3.1. And it says, if the contractor is delayed at any time in the commencement or progress of the work by an act or neglect of the owner, the architect, or a separate contractor, 2, by changes to order in the work, 3, by labor disputes or other causes beyond the contractor's control, by mediation, 4, or by other causes the contractor asserts an architect deems justified delay, the contract time shall be extended for such reasonable time as the architect may determine. So 831 is basically saying, if there are issues outside of my control that I have nothing to do with, I being the contractor, any of these 5 issues, if they come up during the course of the project, I am entitled, the contract time shall be extended for such reasonable time as the architect may determine. So I have a project schedule that I'm going to finish your house in 10 months. You come to me under sub 2 and you have a change order in the work and you come to me as the owner and the owner says, I want a new bathroom. That will add to the schedule because it's sub 2. Or if the architect has failed to properly design how the roof structure is going to go and has to be figured out or fixed, the architect's delay or the delay to fix that under 1 would entitle the contractor to an extension of the contract time. If there's a labor dispute or a fire, some other issue that happens that's beyond my control, the contractor gets an extension of time. So that's what A31 is. It's important to recognize that even though I, as the contractor, am agreeing that the schedule is reasonable and fair, and I'm agreeing as the contractor will meet substantial completion, if something changes and it's not my fault and I can't control it, you must give me an extension to the schedule. Okay? Any questions about time? Now, I will add, and then let's take a quick break after this. I will add that there are a bunch of provisions out there that talk about things called force majeure and other details and what needs to go into the schedule and everything else. And you will see those during the course of your work as how do you create a more detailed schedule and so forth. But for the purposes of the exam, you just need to know these kind of short provisions that I had in Article 8 about time and who's responsible for what. So, all right, it's 5 after 10. Let's take a quick 5-minute break, and then we'll come back and we'll start working on payments and completion, because those are important, and kind of zip through some of the other provisions. All right? Thanks, guys. Okay, let's continue on, if everybody's back. We're going to talk about payments and completion. So obviously, as the project moves along, you need to have a process by which the contractor gets paid. So this is a very important provision, near and dear to the hearts of the contractor. What's interesting, though, as important of a provision this is, and the contractors want to make sure that they are getting paid, this section of the agreement probably has the least amount of negotiations that I find, and it's probably because the system that is implemented in this contract has been used for so many years that the contractors are pretty comfortable with it. And in fact, I have, as when I represent an owner, I have some additional edits that go into this Article 9 on payments and completion about how we are able to track the payments and how we're able to protect ourselves from what's called mechanics liens and other things. And even those rarely get pushback or negotiated between the parties because, by and large, the payment process is pretty well honed in the AAA contracts. So we'll run through it, but know that most of the time when you guys are in the process of working with owners, you're not going to have to advise them on how to adjust these provisions. You're just going to have to understand them because you'll have a role to play as we get through it, and we'll talk about that. Okay. Article 9-1-1 is just definition, contract sum. And it's the total amount payable by the owner to the contractor for the performance of the work. So that's just a simple definition term. 9.2. If unit prices are stated in the contract documents, and if the quantities that are contemplated are materially changed, such substantial equity the owner contractor, the applicable unit prices shall be equitably adjusted. So what this is saying in 9.2 is, so unit price can come into a different forms. Instead of saying, I'm going to build that brick wall for $100, I'm going to charge you per brick. And that brick price includes the labor and all the materials. So it's not just the brick, it's the mortar, it's the labor to install it. That's called a unit price. Unit prices come into, often they come into things like road construction, how many linear feet, or it may come into how many cubic yards of concrete or cubic yards of dirt, or if you're doing electrical work, how much linear feet of copper that you're going to be putting in, or plumbing conduit, or whatever. So all of them are based on a unit, feet, inches, metric, meters, cubic yards, weight, volume, whatever it is. And you determine a price of what that is per unit, and it's based on the value, because so sometimes if you have 100 units, it's one price. If you have 1,000 units, it's obviously going to be less because of the economy of scale. So 9.2 says if you have unit prices in a contract, and that could be just for one portion of it, and the quantities materially change, if there's an equity to the owner of the contractor, there should be an equitable adjustment. So if I thought I was going to put in 100 units and I'm charging you $5 a unit, but now you've told me I'm going to put in 1,000, well, there's no way I should be getting a cheaper price than $5 a unit. Once, if we go from 100 to 1,000 because of quantity of scale, maybe it's $350 a unit. So we have to adjust the contract. Obviously, it's going to go up because now you're doing 1,000 units, but the per unit price should be adjusted down to make sure it's equitable for both parties. And that would result in a change order as to how the unit prices are determined. So that's 9.2. Is there a typo here? So maybe that was... Hold on. Yeah, it says, just as a correction here, as I'm looking at this, it says 9.2, but it actually should be 9.1.2 as far as the number for this paragraph. Because 9.2 is called the Schedule of Values. So the Schedule of Values is another important document that you guys need to understand should be in the contract. Now, what's interestingly enough, as you can see in this paragraph, the term Schedule of Values, where did it go? In this third sentence here, this fourth line down, is not capitalized. Now, that means it's not a defined term. So when I talk to you about sometimes I'll edit this provision, sometimes we'll edit it because I want the Schedule of Value to be a specific type of document in a specific form. So it becomes a defined term when I edit it. But the concept of the Schedule of Values is it's the it's a list of all the work that's going to be done, allocating the entire contract sum to various portions of the work. So what you're going to have is you're going to have a line that's going to say plumbing, and then it's going to have a price. Then you're going to have a line that says electrical, and then it's going to have a price. Then you're going to have a sign that says rough carpentry, a price, finished carpentry, concrete, stone, steel. Each one of the specific individual types of work that's being performed on the project will be identified in this list with a price to it. And that list becomes a schedule of those line items that will be in the project, of values, the pricing for that. And included also in that schedule of values will be the contractor's, like the cost for my general conditions, the cost for my fee, the cost for my superintendent on the project site as labor only. So those will all be listed in the schedule of values. And let's say I'm building that factory for you for $10 million. When you get to the bottom of that list, it should add up to $10 million, whatever the contract price is. So it's an allocation of the entire contract sum to various important portions of the work. And it's very important for the reason why it says, shall be used as a basis for reviewing the contractor's applications for payment. Now you see that is a defined term with capitals. And an application for payment is basically the contractor's invoice, but that's what they call it in construction world, application for payment. So when the contractor starts on the project, they're going to give you the schedule of value for everything that's going to be working on the project, what you're going to be performing to build the project from the very beginning. And then, after that first month, they dug a hole, they put some formwork up, and they poured concrete. So they're going to submit an invoice that says, here's the cost for digging the hole, and here's the cost for the formwork, which would be rough carpentry, and here's the cost for pouring the concrete. And I'm then going to take, as the architect or the owner or the owner's rep, I'm going to take that initial schedule values with everything, and then I'm going to take that and I'm going to compare it to the pay application. And if there's a line item for excavation and there's only one hole to be dug and it says $50,000, then the application of payment will say $50,000 for excavation, and you're good because they match. If it says 60 or 70 or 80, they don't match that schedule of values. You need to find out why it was more money, and you shouldn't have to necessarily pay them for that. Depends on how the contract's written, but you use it as a check and balance. Then you look at rough carpentry. Well, the formwork is not the only rough carpentry. The formwork is going to go to build the forms to pour the concrete in, but you have framing. Framing is rough carpentry. So you look at that, and it's going to say $25,000 for rough carpentry. The schedule of values may say $200,000 because only 1/8 of the work that's being done, or whatever that percentage is, 1/8 of the $200,000 relates to the form work. So you have to do a comparison of percentages. So the architect or the owner's rep will understand sequencing of payments and work being performed in percentages, and they will use that schedule of values with the application for payment as a check and balance. And so that's why it's really important in the beginning to kind of lock down each and every line item adds up to the $10 million. And you want to make sure there's nothing missing or hidden. And then what happens is, it also says at the end of this thing, it says, shall be used as a basis for reviewing the contractor's subsequent applications for payment. So it's not just the first one. But the second one comes in, and they poured more concrete, because they didn't get it all done before the first one. And then they start to frame more, and then they start putting in some of the conduit. Well, that's going to go, and you'll look over the line item, and you're going to say, oh, the schedule of values has the $200,000 for rough carpentry. We had $25,000 for the first month, and we had another $50,000 because we're starting to framing. So now we've spent $75,000 of the $200,000. It matches of what the percentage of work is. So you keep using that initial schedule of values as you work through the process of the project and keep getting billed over. And then sometime later, 5-6 months down the road, you're going to get, you know, installing of drywall. And then you go back to that very initial schedule of values, and it'll have a line item for drywall. So you'll be able to find all the process, all the payment, all the costs on that initial schedule of values. So it's an important document, and you need to understand how it works. Any questions on that? Okay. 9.3, applications for payments. So it's an itemized, that's like I said, it's their invoice. The contractor shall submit to the architect, or sometimes the owner's rep, an itemized application for payment prepared in accordance with the schedule of values. So there's a directive. Contractor, if you're going to give us the pay app, your line items on your invoice need to match the line items you told me about in the schedule of values, so I can make an apples-to-apples comparison. And then you're going to need to be supported by all data substantiating the contractor's right for payment that the owner and the architect require. So if you're telling me that you spent $25,000 on excavation, I want to see the invoice from your excavator's subcontractor that they charge you $25,000. You can't just put down on your pay app, here's my cost, without backup documentation. It makes sense. So give somebody, so the owner can review it and make sure that they're tracking the costs. The other reason why sometimes this comes into play is you may have a contract structure for payment whereby if the contractor comes in less than what they listed, so if they listed $200,000 and they are able to build it, whatever that line item is, for $175,000, then the owner saves $25,000 on the project. But if the contractor wasn't required to give the backup data, the owner may never know that there was a savings, and the contractor could pocket it. So you want to make sure, if you're depending, again, there's sometimes when you don't have to provide data, but most of the time you want to see that backup data to make sure that the contractor is fairly billing you for the work being performed. Okay, that's 7.3.1. 7.3.1.1, the applications may include requests for payments on account of changes in the work, but improperly authorized by constructive change directives or interim determinations by the architect. So, as I said, you went up to Kohler as a contractor, you bought the $5,000 bathtub and the $1,600 toilet and the gold-plated fixtures and everything else, but we haven't agreed to a change order, so I'm going to still bill you because the CCD authorizes me to do that, that concept that's in 7.3.9. So, what we've done on the way the contract, this contract, the AAA contract is drafted, is we've tied a payment provision to a change order process. So we've closed the loop on the process to make sure payment is allowed. Okay? 9.3.1.2 shall not, though, however, include requests for payments of portions which the contractor does not intend to pay a subcontractor supplier. So let's say there's a beef between the subcontractor and the contractor. So there's work being performed. Let's say some plumbing work's put in, but it's done poorly. And the architect, you guys as the architect, go out to the project site and you're looking, you're like, oh my God, this plumbing work is awful. Well, the work's been done, and so the contractor says, you're right, it's terrible, we need to get it fixed. So I'm going to go back to my plumber and have them fix it. Now there's a squabble between the contractor and the plumber. The plumber doesn't want to have to come out and do it again because it's going to cost them money that they won't get ever recoup. So in that instance, if the contractor knows that it's not going to pay the sub until the work is performed or the sub has fixed it, the contractor cannot bill you for that. They have to make sure that whatever they're going to pay, what you're going to pay, you as the owner are going to pay the contractor, that the contractor is going to move that money downstream to the sub. The reason why you have this is because if there is some issue and the contractor fails to pay the sub may file a mechanic's lien against the property and tie it up in court for those funds, and the owner's going to say, I don't want to have to pay twice. I paid you, contractor, based on 9.3.1.2 of you agreeing that if I pay you, you're going to pay them. Well, you didn't pay them, so I don't want to get into squabble with that. So I don't want to be part of that. In fact, as a result of that, you're in breach because you said you're not going to include in your pay request something you didn't intend to pay your sub. So that's what 9.3.1.2 is. 9.3.2 is just talking about where you can store materials and that's often on the site. 9.3.3, the contractor warrants. Here, warrant is such like a guarantee that all title to the work covered by an application for payment will pass to the owner no later than the time of payment. Meaning if I installed an air conditioning unit in your property, and there's a warranty on that, and it's a big unit, as soon as you pay me, the title to that air conditioning unit goes to you. You own it, and you have the title on that equipment. That's important, because I'll give you an example of a project that I had that did not have this provision. We had a project where there was a very expensive piece of equipment. It was about a $14 or $15 million piece of equipment that was to be installed in the project. The contractor delivered it to the project site, but actually put it on pallets just outside the physical geographical site itself. So the site has a legal description of where the boundaries are of the site. And the contractor delivered it and kept it, for lack of better terms, outside of the fence. And it was, like I said, like a $14 or $15 million piece of equipment. Contractor billed us for it because it came, it arrived, it was there, so they billed us. And my client paid. And then the contractor got into financial difficulties and did not pay the manufacturer of that piece of equipment. So the manufacturer came and repossessed it and took it back. And the owner said, no, I own that because I paid for it, so I own it. Makes sense, right? I paid for it, I own it. But it didn't have this language that said title will pass to the owner no later than the time of payment. So the owner, the manufacturer said, you don't own it, I still have title. And you can't prove that you have title, and there was no contractual language, so you can go sue the contractor. But the contractor was saying, hey, it's not my problem. And there was also an issue with this one, because it was sitting on pallets outside of the project site, we couldn't stop the manufacturer from coming, because if they came on our project site, even if title hadn't passed, they would have been trespassing and taking the equipment that was on our land. But in fact, it wasn't on our land. So this is an important provision that says, upon payment, title passes. I become the owner as the owner. And it also is free and clear of liens and other security interests. You've got to make sure that manufacturer or the subcontractors or whoever's done the work don't have some other legal claim to the equipment or the material or the work or whatever it might be, because I pay for it, I get title to it, and they're not going to file a mechanic's lien against me. Any questions on that? Okay. 9.4, certificates of payment. Okay, so a certificate of payment is something that happens in a project where you come in and you've seen the contractor's pay app. You received it, and within 7 days, you're going to issue to the owner a certificate of payment in full amount of the application for payment. So you've looked at it, looked at the application for payment, you've cross-referenced against the schedule of values, and you walked around the site, and you say, yeah, what the pay app says, what the invoice says, matches the schedule of values and matches the work performed on the site. So I, as the architect, will now certify that payment should be made. And you have to do it within a certain period of time. And then the architect is notifying the contractor and the architect of your reasons, if there's a reason to withhold. Let's say you say, you know what, they're asking for money for concrete, but that concrete wall looks like it has cracks, so there must have been some issue with the mortar or the temperature when they poured it, and so I'm not going to certify the payment for the respect to concrete until we have further testing. I'm going to withhold. So there may be reasons for certifying some, not all. And that's what happens in this 941. It's you have to, within a certain period of time, certify it. If you are going to withhold, you have to give information about why you're withholding it, and then the parties go from there. Okay? 942, once you issue the certificate of payment, it will constitute a representation by the architect to the owner. And here's where you guys remember this from your B101. But to the best of the architect knowledge, information, and belief. But it's not a guarantee. It's a representation to the best of your knowledge and information and belief. But the fact, the work has progressed along far enough. So this is kind of saying, I looked at it, I reviewed it, I checked it, I did everything I could, and this is the best knowledge and information and belief that I'm certifying what is owed under the contract, 942. However, that certification does not mean, and again, exact same language. Remember I told you, you're going to see repeated language. You didn't make an exhaustive or continuous on-site inspection. You didn't review the construction's need, methods, sequence, and procedures. You didn't look at the subcontractor invoices to see that they got paid. And you haven't determined where the contractor has paid its money. So these are your, as the architect, yes, I'm certifying it, but I'm certifying it based on these qualifications or these clarifications. Okay? 9.5, decisions to withhold certification. So why would you withhold? Well, and you can withhold and hold in part. It's to protect the owner. If you walk around and you see a cracking concrete wall, you don't want to pay the contractor for that wall. You got to make sure it's right. And so, if you can't certify it under 9.5.1, you need to notify the contractor and the owner. And then if the contractor and architect can't agree on a revised amount, then the architect basically has carte blanche to say, well, this is how much I think you should be paid. So you try to have a discussion. So the concept of 951 is the parties are going to be notified and they're supposed to talk about it. They're supposed to come to a fair and equitable release of the funds based on why there may be a withholding of payment. And if you can't come to an agreement, then the architect says, this is what I'm paying. 951 continued lists the items of why you would want to withhold payment. So one is, there's defective work that hasn't been fixed. Two, a third party has filed a claim, say a mechanic's lien or whatever. So one of the subcontractors says, I haven't been paid, I'm going to file a claim against the property. So you would withhold, the owner says, I don't want to pay twice, so I'm going to withhold money there. Three, if we know the contractor's not paying the subcontractor, I don't want to keep giving money to a contractor if they're not paying the subs. I mean, that's like throwing good money after bad. I've had plenty of times where a contractor's in financial difficulty and they have three projects ago that you have nothing to do with are in a lawsuit and they owe money to the subcontractors and the owners. And you pay them on your job and they take the money from your job and pay off the bills from three projects ago. Well, that doesn't help you because it now puts you at risk. So if you know that's going on, that's a reason to withhold payment. If there's evidence that you can't finish that factory for the balance of the contract sum, if it's a $10 million job and it's clear that it can't be finished for $10 million, you can withhold payment and say, you know what, you're never going to get it done. I'm going to have to bring somebody else in to make up, and I don't want to, again, pay good money after bad. You've overspent, you're delayed, you've done all these other problems, so I'm going to hold on that money because I don't think you could ever finish this for $10 million, and I'll bring in the next party. If the owner has damage or the separate contractor has damage, if the work can't be finished within the contract time, so if the delay is too much, or just repeated failure to carry out the work. If you just are screwed up and you haven't done it right, these are all reasons of why you can withhold payment. Any questions on that? Okay. There's a couple other things in this under 952 and 953. The important one on this screen is 954. If the architect withholds certification for payment under section 95313, the owner may, at its sole option, issue joint checks to the contractor and any subcontractor or supplier. So this is an example where, remember I told you that the contractor's paying someone else, or maybe they're in a squabble with the subcontractor, and it may not even be in a squabble or a dispute over your job. It may be another job. Who knows what's happening? But if your architect walks the site, and they look around and they say, you know, the electrical work looks fine, and it looks like they're billing the right amount, and it's on schedule. So I don't know why the contractor's not paying the electrician, but I like their work. I need them to continue to work. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to recommend, I, the architect, that payment should be made, but the owner under 954 can say to the contractor, I don't want you giving this money to anybody else. I want it to go to the electrician. It can't even go in your pocket. So instead of giving you a direct check just to you, contractor, to figure out what to do with it, I'm going to give you a joint check. And that $250,000 that the subcontractor's invoiced will be made payable to you and the sub to make sure that that money isn't improperly spent. So, again, an easy concept to grasp, but we want to make sure it's in the agreement so the parties know what's going to happen if there's these disputes or squabbles. Now, I've had this happen on many projects. It's not common, but it's not uncommon. Like I said, I've over the years, I've had well over 15 or 20 projects that require joint checks to be issued. Often happens at the end when you're trying to resolve, like, the work out the end of the completion of the project. So, progress payments. So your progress payments is the month-to-month process. And 962 is under 96 is progress payments. 956.2 requires 7 days. So this is like a prompt payment concept. So once the contractor gets paid by the owner, this requires the contractor to pay its subs within 7 days. So that, again, payment keeps the project moving, time is money. So this is by requirement. Once I pay you, you must pay them. You need to keep the ball rolling downstream. Happy subcontractor, the work is happy, and it keeps moving along. And then the contractor, it also requires the contractor to make the same agreement with its subs, so the subs pay the sub-subs. So this clause that says contractor has to pay you sub in 7 days needs to be in the subcontractor agreement that says subcontractor needs to pay the sub-sub in 7 days. Again, prompt payment, moving things along. 963 you don't need to worry about. 964. The owner has the right to request written evidence from the contractor that they have properly paid the subs. If they fail to furnish evidence within 7 days, the owner shall have the right to contact the subcontractors and suppliers directly. So here, you may be on a project site where subs are talking, we're not getting paid, there's something going on, you know. They come to the owner's rep or they come to the architect and say, what's going on? We haven't been paid. So under 964, the owner is allowed to write and ask from the contractor, I want proof in writing that you've been making payments. They're telling me you're not making payments. And if the contractor doesn't give us that evidence, then technically I'm not allowed, as the owner, I'm not allowed to reach out directly to the subcontractors. That's a breach of what's called a tortious interference with contractual relations. You don't have to worry about that for the exam. But under the law, if I'm in agreement with you, the contractor, between an owner and contractor, owner's not supposed to be talking directly to the subs. But this provision says, if in fact I ask for evidence that you've been paying your subs and you don't give that to me, I'm not in violation of that rule. I actually can talk to them directly because you've agreed to that process right here. And that's important. I had a big project where I went to litigation and we were the direct contractor and we had a sub that was doing installation work for us. And interestingly enough, not during the project,
But after the project was completed, and we were in the big lawsuit about the cost to fix the project, the owner, who I was up against, started talking to my subcontractor behind the scenes. And to have them both come in and work to fix the project, even though they were the ones that allegedly screwed it up, but also to testify negatively against my client, the general contractor. And during the course of the depositions, this came out that the contractor, the subcontractor and the owner were talking behind the scenes in violation of this very provision that you're looking at, 964. And as a result of that, we leveraged that to help us in the trial, to use this to our advantage, because not only had the owner improperly withheld money from my client, but they were breaching the contract by going and trying to do an end around and trying to get our subcontractor to be favorable to them. So that was helpful for us in the case. 966 is important. What this says is if there's a certificate of payment or a progress payment, so even if I paid the contractor and the architect is certified, it does not constitute an acceptance of work not in accordance with the contract documents. So what does that mean? Well, I'm the architect, I'm walking around the site, and I saw them installing the plumbing in the month of February. And I approved the February pay application, but not all the plumbing was completed. The next time I'm on the project site in March as the architect, I'm walking around, and the drywall's up. So now I can't see the plumbing because it's behind the drywall. So presumably it was done correctly because I accepted it when I could see it. So the architect will certify payment, the plumbing was completed, they've taken on the face value, and the owner pays. Now it turns out that the plumbing that was not seen, that they couldn't be seen behind the walls, was improper and done incorrectly. So the owner needs to come back to the contractor either by suit or some other type of method and says, you need to fix your defective plumbing. 966 says the contractor can't now come back and say, no, I don't need to fix it, you accepted it. You know, you paid by everywhere, so it's, you get what you get. No, what 966 says is just because I paid you doesn't mean if you weren't in accordance with the contract documents. If you did it wrong, doesn't mean I'm accepting the work. It just means I paid you for what we believe you were entitled to. Now, I as the owner may have to prove that you did it wrong, but that's what this says. This gives me the opportunity at least to prove that the plumbing work was done incorrectly. And therefore, the architect, just because they couldn't see it, wasn't certifying that the work was done properly. Okay? Provided that the owner has fulfilled its payment obligations under the contract, meaning if you gave me an invoice and I paid you, contractor shall defend and indemnify the owner from all loss, liability, damage, expertise, including reasonable fees, attorney's fees, and litigation expenses arising out of any lien claim or other claim for payment by a sub or supplier. So, I've mentioned mechanics liens a bunch of times in the class. I think I've given a definition, but I'll give it again. In the world of contracts and construction, if we go back to our triangle, at the top we have the owner. We have solid lines from owner to contractor and owner to architect. And underneath the contractor and the architect, on the architect side, there's other consultants, your mechanical engineer, electrical engineer. And under the contractor, there's an electrician, a plumber, an HVAC guy, rough carpentry team, whatever they might be. So those are on that side. If you remember from our lectures on contracts, the owner and that electrician are not in direct contract, so they can't sue each other for breach of contract. But the subcontractor, the electrician, has done the work, and if she's done the work and she's not getting paid, she has a breach of contract with the contractor. That's true, because the contractor is the one that promised to pay her by that subcontract agreement. But the party that's benefiting from her electrical work on the project is the owner. And so what she wants to do is be able to say, how do I get money from the owner who's benefiting from the fruits of my labor? Well, that's what's called a mechanics lien. And so that allows the subcontractor to file a lien against the property and try to claim you, owner, are improperly benefiting from my work of installing that electrical equipment. I haven't been paid, so you need to pay me. Or the contractor needs to pay me. Whoever needs to pay me, they need to pay me because I did the work, it was done right, and the owner's enjoying the benefit of it. But nine, so that's a mechanic's lien, and that can happen in any project for any of the trades down below that second tier. They're all allowed to file liens. First tier are as well, but that doesn't happen as often. But anybody can file a lien on the property as long as they performed work and as long as the owner's enjoying benefit from them. Even architects can file mechanic's liens under the Illinois law. What 968 says is if I, the owner, paid you, contractor, and I paid you properly and timely, and then I get this mechanic's lien claim against me, I've already paid you for it. You promised you'd pay them downstream. So if I get the mechanic's lien claim against me as the owner, you must step in, contractor, and defend me and pay legal fees and anything else that comes up with this to defend against this, which may or may not be a proper mechanic's lien action, but you need to protect me because I paid you. So that's what 968 says. Now, if the owner hasn't properly paid, all bets are off. But if, as long as I paid you, you, contractor, have to be my shield. Protect me from the subcontractor asking for more money. Okay? 9-7. Failure of payment. So now we have the owner that doesn't pay. So what happens for that? If the architect does not issue certificate of payment through no fault of the contractor, so if the contractor didn't do anything wrong, but the architect doesn't issue certificate within 7 days, or the owner does not pay the contractor within 7 days after the date established in the contract documents, so, you know, net due in 15 days, net due in 30 days, whatever it is. If they haven't paid within 7 days of when it's established, the amount certified by the architect or awarded by binding dispute resolution, then the contractor may, upon 7 additional days' notice, stop the work. So it's just an authority that says, you pay me when you owe me. If you haven't done it within 7 days, I'm going to send you a letter, and 7 days from that, I'm going to stop work. So let's say that the payout comes in January 1, I'm supposed to pay you by the end of the month, by January 30th, because we're on a 30-day payment cycle. If I haven't paid you by February 6th, 7 days later, contractor can write me a letter that says, you are late, you should have paid me January 30th, you haven't paid me, it's February 6th. If you don't pay me, within the next 7 days, I'm going to stop work. That's what that process works. That's what the 9-7 is. Okay? It's to protect, obviously, protect the contractor and keep payment moving fast. 9-8, substantial completion. So as I said, the stage of completion, the stage in the progress of the work when the work is the designated portion thereof is sufficiently complete in accordance with the contract document so the owner can occupy or utilize the work for its intended use. Also, like I said, fit for its intended use and purposes. So that's what substantial completion as a defined term is. So how does that process work? Under 982, when the contractor believes that it's substantially complete, they're going to raise their hand and they're going to tell the architect about it. And they're also going to submit a list to the architect of those additional items, sometimes called a punch list, of little minor things that need to be completed. I know I got to repaint that wall there. There's a ding there. There's a couple things. I got to finish the flower beds in the front of the house, so forth and so on. But the house is done. So I'm telling you, I'm giving you notice, the contractor is giving the notice to the architect and owner that I'm substantially complete, I believe, and I'm going to give you this list. So that's the process that it starts. Then once we get the list under 983, the architect inspects it to make sure, is it substantially complete or not? And the architect walks around with that punch list, that list of little things like finishing putting the flowers in the garden and the dings and dents and a couple little painting issues. And they walk around with that punch list and see if they agree. Almost 100% of the time, the architect's punch list is going to be longer than the contractor. But that's okay. You want to make sure it's done right. So you get to an agreement what that punch list is.
There may be also things on that list that need to be fixed before substantial completion is approved. And so that's what the second part of 983 says. The contractor shall, before issuance of certificate of completion, complete or correct such item upon notification of the architect. So the architect's going to walk around and is going to say, okay, you're right, you got a ding here, you got to repaint here, but it's not that you just have to plant a couple flowers. You have to grade the entire lawn of the house. You have to put in the beds. And there's a bunch of trees sitting over there that are still in their canvas balls. That's a lot of work. That's going to take 2 or 3 weeks. I know you believe the physical house is completed, but these are also part of the project and the work. So the architect's going to say you are not substantially complete until you finish grading the lawn and putting in the trees and finishing this. And once you complete and correct that, then I'm going to issue the certificate. So that's how that process. And it could be anything. It could be, you know, this equipment's missing, or there's too many defects, or whatever it is. And so that process happens, and once the contractor then believes it's finished, and under the end of 9.8.3, they come back and say, hey, make another inspection. Come back and take a look at it again. We believe we're substantially complete this time. And again, this is a process that happens all the time in the project. So you, as the architect, would be responsible for performing that inspection, making an objective review and analysis, and then ultimately, sometime at least, issuing a substantial completion certificate. 9.8.4. When the work of designated proportion is substantially complete, the architect will prepare that certificate and shall establish a date. Now, this is very important for two reasons. Well, there are many reasons, but two big reasons for purposes of the owner and the contractor. That date, that certified date. The first is warranties required by the contract documents shall commence on the date of substantial completion. So you're going to have equipment, like we'll go use the house example. The dishwasher, the refrigerator, the air conditioner, the furnace, the humidifier, all these pieces of equipment. And they may have been up and running. You know, they may be, the contractor is working on the plumbing inside the house. It's in the middle of the summer and the air conditioner is installed. And that air conditioning unit's been up and running through June, July, and August. And the workers are inside working, or whatever, it's the winter and they want to have it warm in there. So the furnace has been working through January, February, March. Well, the warranty, however, for that equipment does not start until substantial completion. Even though you ran the furnace for 3 months, when the project is substantially complete, the 12-month warranty on that furnace isn't 3 months already in. That 12 months starts on substantial completion. No matter what happened before, no matter what usage, no matter what the contractor did or didn't with the equipment, all those warranties, those 1 year, 5 year, 10 year roof warranties, whatever they might be, do not begin until substantial completion. So that's a very important date. And why that's you as the architect need to make sure, am I doing the right certification? So that's one side. The other side is, there's this thing called retainage. There's more money released to the contractor, payments made to the contractor on date of substantial completion. And that'll be coming up a little bit later in this section. So the certificate of substantial completion and the date that you certify as the architect is very important. And then also under 985, if there's a bond on the project, then there's going to be some language that talks about upon acceptance and consent of the surety, the owner shall make payment of retainage, so the surety has to sign off on it, applying to the work or designated proportion thereof. Like I said, I'll talk a little bit about retainage in a minute, but again, this is a trigger. Substantial completion triggers warranty commencement and retainage release. So when we get to more about retainage, I'll explain what it is in detail. Partial occupancy and use, 9.9. This provision allows you to have the owner can come in and start using the building before substantial completion. So think about if you're building a condo building, and it's a 15-story condo building. Well, you want to start selling the units on the top floor because you're carrying, if you remember from our economics of construction lecture a couple weeks ago, you're carrying the loan on that project. And if you can sell some of those units, you can draw down on your loan. relevant. Does it make sense if the units on the top three floors, the 12, 13, 14, 15, top four floors, if those are completed and finished out and are good and substantially complete, but they're still building the ones down lower, does it make sense that you have to wait? No, what you'd like to be able to do is say, okay, the lobby's finished, you get the lobby done first and the garage, and then you finish out the top floors, and then you allow people to start moving in. Now, construction's still ongoing, and you have to set up some parameters for what happens, but this provision allows the owner to occupy a portion of the building prior to substantial completion. And so maybe you set it up that the warranties for the equipment relating to those top units start kicking in. So you have to have some other language in the agreement as to handle warranties and retainage release. But what 991 says, we could, if we need to, have partial occupancy prior to full substantial completion. And we have this to kind of sign off on it. And then 993, unless otherwise agreed upon, partial occupancy use or a portion or portions of the work shall not constitute acceptance of the work. So again, just because, same thing like payment, gotta remember, just because I paid you doesn't mean I'm agreeing you did the work right. If you screwed it up and I couldn't tell or whatever, I paid you because we needed to move the project along. Same thing is, just because I moved in doesn't mean I'm agreeing you did the work right. In any instance, no matter what happens, the contractor is obligated to perform the work in accordance with the contract documents. Okay, so we had commencement, we had progress, we had substantial completion, all the big stuff is finished, the building is fit for its intended uses and purposes. How do we get from this mostly finished, we're at the, we can see it, we're at the 10-yard line, the 5-yard line, how do we get to final completion? And that's Article 9.10. And again, what's going to happen is, after we do substantial completion, there's going to be this punch list. The contractor's going to have this list. The contractor and the architect are going to agree to what's the 10 or 15 or 200 items on the list. And then the contractor's going to, what they call, punch it out. They're going to finish punching out the project. When the contractor thinks they've done everything on the list, 9.10.1, contractor is going to give notice. Upon receiving the contractor's notice, and the architect, you, the architect, are going to come back and make another inspection. And you're going to take that punch list that everybody agreed to that's got the 50 items on it, and you're going to walk around and you say, yep, they fixed that, yep, they fixed that, no, they didn't fix that, no, they didn't fix this. And you go through and you find out, you say, you've got 38 of the 50. I'm not giving you final completion. You got to finish these other 12. Now, there may be a squabble about it, there may be some resolution over it and everything else, but until you finish, until we get everything done, I'm not going to issue final certificate of payment. And that final certificate is the last release of the last amount of money that the owner's holding on. So the owner's going to hold on to this concept called retainage coming up that protects the owner against problems that happen up to substantial completion or to final completion. So this is all based on the architect's on-site visits and inspections. And it's based on the architect's best knowledge, information, and belief. So they're doing, you're doing your best. It's not a guarantee by the architect, but it is an obligation the architect has to certify final completion, just like they're certifying substantial completion. 9.10.2. Neither final payment nor any retainage percentages shall become due until the architect submits, and there's a list of things here, 1 through 3, and then we'll go more on the next page. Certificate of insurance is there, that you've paid everybody, that you know that the insurance will not be renewable. So there's this list of things that have to come into place. Documentation of any special warranties, releases of any lien waivers, any other suspending disputes. And so what happens is the owner will never release final payment until the contractor says everything's clean and clear. Here's a warranty for your roof. I'm handing it to you. Here's the owner's manual for operating that piece of equipment. I'm turning that over for you. Here's proof that I've paid all the subcontractors and we're not in any disputes. Remember that lien that the electrician filed a couple months ago? Here's proof that we've paid them and the lien has been released. So this list of a half a dozen items
And sometimes you may want more. You can modify the agreement to add more. But the contractor must provide this proof and this data in addition to finishing that punch list before they're at what's called final completion. And until we get all this punch list work finished and these half a dozen line items completed and signed off on by the contractor, the owner does not need to make payment to the contractor for final payment. So that's what 9.10.2 says. 9.10.3 is a protection for the contractor. If after substantial completion, so we got to the finish line mostly, we got to that 10-yard line, if final completion is materially delayed through no fault of the contractor, maybe the owner has some issues, maybe the architect has some issues, whatever it might be, but it's not my fault, it's the contractor. And that affects final completion, or if the owner has a change or what have you, the owner shall, upon application of the contractor and certificate by the architect, make payment for balance due for that work of that portion of the work fully completed, corrected, and acceptance. So maybe what happens is everything in that condo building is completed, but somewhere along the line the architect had a change in a specification for the lobby to have a certain kind of tile that was on the back wall, like a decorative element, but it was part of the project. And it fell on the punch list. It wasn't for substantial completion because you could use it without that decorative element on the back wall. But for final completion, it's required. The contractor's like, I ordered it. It's on back order. It's not going to come in for 6 months. We can get something different, but if you want this, it's going to be 6 months. Not the fault of the contractor. And the contractor says, look, here's my warranties. Here's all the payment proof. Here's everything else. What ends up happening for that, based on 9.10.3, is you pay for everything, the balance of that due for that portion of the work fully completed and corrected. It allows you to close out as much of the project as needed, so long as the delay to achieving final completion is not due to the contractor. So, any questions on that? Right. 9.10.4. So upon making the payment of making final payment, the owner is waiving claims except for these four. If there's a lien filed against the property, the owner can bring a claim against the contractor. It says, hey, even though I paid you final and everything else, I got a lien now. You got to step back in and protect me, because that's what it said in the contract, and I haven't waived that claim. If the work was broken or defective, again, just because I paid you doesn't mean that I'm saying the work is proper. I'm not waiving a claim against you for defective work. If the warranties, if that piece of equipment, if the roof fails, if something happens after the warranties are kicked in, but I paid you for final completion, I'm not waiving a warranty claim for you. And if I potentially think that you've overbilled me and I want to come in and audit you, I'm not waiving my audit against you. So these four things, just because I've paid you, I'm not waiving these four things. There may be other things I'm waiving, but at least these four I'm preserving to be able to bring, I as owner, can bring a claim against the contractor. On the flip side, under 9.10.5, acceptance of the final payment by contractor shall constitute a waiver of claims by that payee, so by the contractor or the subcontractor who's accepting the payment. And it's a waiver of all claims except those previously made in writing and identified at the time of final application for payment. So if I am the owner and I issue final payment and you, contractor, haven't called something out, you can't come back later and say you owe me more money. You, as the contractor or subcontractor, must identify in writing prior to final payment that you're reserving a claim against me, the owner, based on X, Y, and Z. If you fail to do that, you've waived all claims going forward after getting final payment. Okay? Any questions on payment? Good. All right. Article 10, protections of persons and property.
So this is about safety and otherwise. 10.1, you have to be responsible for maintaining and supervising safety precautions and programs. That's pretty common. If you remember, architect has nothing to do with safety, contractor has everything to do with safety. 10.2, they have to provide reasonable protection to prevent damage, injury, or loss to employees, to the work, other property. So these are things that they must take care of the site and anything that's adjacent to the site. And if something goes wrong, if a person's injured, and it's due to a safety issue, contractor can be liable. If there's materials that's defective and otherwise due to safety issues, contractor's liable. Or if the next door neighbor's, if the wall falls down on the next door neighbor's property, contractor's liable. And these may result in claims where there's indemnity or otherwise, but all of these are the obligations of the contractor for safety under 10.1 and 10.2. 10.2.2. Pretty simple. Contractors supply, comply with and give notice as required by all applicable laws, statutes, ordinance, codes, rules and regulations, and lawful orders of public authorities. It's simply stating, if it's not in the contract, then it's required by law, you got to follow it. If there's a code, if it's OSHA, if it's a building code, whatever it might be, contractor, just because I didn't write it down in the contract, doesn't mean you aren't responsible. 10.2.3 and 10.2.4 talks about explosions or different types of other types of safety, fire hazards, things like that. So those are other items that we're calling out in the contract that the contractor is responsible for. 10.2.5. Excuse me a second. So if there's something wrong, if there's a defect, under sections 10.2.1.2 and 10.2.1.3, cause and hold by the contractor, so some safety issue back there, the contractor must promptly remedy the damage and loss. And that's not only from themselves, but any subcontractor, anybody else for whom they're reliable. So anybody, if you go back to that triangle, owner to contractor, and then all the people under the contractor's umbrella, if there's any issues that result, contractor is responsible for making sure that they are remedied under 10.2.5. And these, this last sentence here, are in addition to their obligations under section 3.18. 3.18 is the indemnity, meaning if there's a third party claim, the contractor has to indemnify. But independent of that indemnity claim, something is problematic or wrong, 10.2.5 says they have to fix it if there was a safety issue and something went wrong. Regardless of whether there's a third party bringing a suit, you're obligated to fix it and correct it. These are talking about who's responsible for site safety. So you don't need to worry about those. 10.2.8. Injury or damage to person or property. If either party suffers injury or damage, so if the owner does or the contractor, notice of the injury or damage, with whether or not insured, shall be given to the other party within a reasonable time, not exceeding 21 days after discovery. So this is for a whole host of reasons that you have to, if there's something that went wrong, some damage or injury, and it could be an person injured, or it could be actually property injured, there has to be notice within 21 days. For a couple of reasons. One, you want to give the other side a reasonable period of time to do investigation. And obviously, if there's something that was defective, the owner wants to point out to the contractor to fix it quickly, or the contractor wants to be able to investigate what's being claimed against it in a short period of time. There's also insurance reasons why you want to report promptly. There's a whole host of things. But this is an obligation that no matter what, if past 21 days happens, you need to give notice. And there's an argument to be made that if you go beyond the 21 days after discovering of this injury or damage, you potentially, whether it's a claim by the owner or a claim by the contractor, you could waive that claim because you've gone past the contractual 21 days. If you remember, time is of the essence for periods. And here's a time period stating if there's injury or damage, you gotta let us know in 21 days. It does not say you were waived, but there's an argument to be made that you've waived. Okay? 10.3, hazardous materials. So what 10.3.1 says, they got to comply with hazardous regulations and requirements. And if the contractor encounters a hazardous material, and if reasonable precautions will be inadequate to prevent bodily injury or death, the contractor shall immediately stop work in the affected area and notify the owner and architect of the condition. Hold on a second here. Okay. So, this is an issue where, if you think about a project, the owner owns the land, and the contractor comes in and builds on it. Now, the contractor, as we'll get into a couple other provisions in a minute, will have responsibilities to not bring hazardous materials on the site. Don't bring caustic chemicals or other things, and if you do, you have to control them and protect them, because if it's part of your means and methods, you're responsible for what you bring in. But there could be existing already on the project site hazardous materials, and you as the contractor are not responsible for what the owner already had on the site. And so, as the contractor's working along, if they find this hazardous material and they can't protect it, they are required to stop work immediately. And the owner and the architect have to come in. It's the owner's land, so the owner's responsible for fixing it. Now, this talks about PCB, but there's a whole host of other things, asbestos and PCB. There's a whole host of other things that could be, that exist on the project site that you don't know what it is. Like, I had a project site that they found radon under, or not radon, but I'm blanking it. It was a radioactive material. And what had happened was that the project site, like 30 or 40 years ago, used to be a factory built near the project site, and the factory built watches. And the watches used a certain type of compound to make the faces of the watches glow in the dark. And that compound was radioactive. They don't obviously use them anymore, but what they did is they would discard this, because there was no controls over it 30, 40, 50 years ago, whatever it was. They would just discard their excess waste of this radioactive material, just throw it in the backyard, in the back of the project site, or the back of the factory, and it seeped into the ground. Well, as the contractor was digging things up to do the new project 40, 50 years later, they did soil sampling, and they tested the soil, and the soil had a small, slight radioactivity. Now, was it bad enough that it was going to harm people? Probably not, but it wasn't the contractor's responsibility. So as a result of that, they stopped work, notified us, the Illinois EPA came in, we had to go through all these different remediation efforts to clean the soil and everything else. And during that period of time when the contractor was delayed, we had to pay the contractor for delay claims because it's not their fault. But this was the provision, it was an AIA agreement, under which the contractor immediately stopped work under 10.3.1 because there was a contaminated soil. 10.3.2 talks about you get a licensed lab, and then the contractor and the architect can reply to the owner whether they have reasonable objections to the person proposed for the lab work. So this is the process by which if there's this hazardous material, how do you fix it? Who's going to be performing the tests? 10.3.3, and in this case, the owner shall indemnify the contractor if there are claims resulting from the hazardous materials. So let's say that irradiated soil because of this compound that was used in watch faces, let's say somebody did have some type of exposure. And if that individual got some type of radiation poisoning or otherwise, because it's on the owner's land, if that worker sued the contractor, the owner needs to step in and defend the contractor, because it was the owner's fault, the owner's land. It's not the contractor's fault, it's the owner. So this is like the one of the few times where the owner is indemnifying the contractor. Always it's the other way around. But this is to protect everybody. And this is also to give a contractor kind of peace of mind. Hey, if I find something wrong, I'm allowed to stop, and I know I'm going to be protected. I'm not going to get, if I get sued, I'm still going to be protected. It's not my fault. So this is a fair provision
Because who knows what's underground? You won't know until you dig it. So any questions on that as far as the owner's responsibility? Okay, 10.3.4 says the owner, now this is the flip side, the owner should not be responsible under this section for hazardous materials the contractor brings to the site unless those materials are required by the contract document. So sometimes the architect or engineer may require certain types of hazardous materials for the performance of the work. In that instance, again, it's the owner or the architect that's responsible. But if the contractor brings in, you know, a certain type of, like, caustic material that they use to clean metals so they can install them, or whatever it might be, if they bring in some hazardous substance, the contractor's responsible under of what they bring under 10.3.4, and the owner is not. And then 10.3.5 says, if there are problems as a result of the contractor's hazardous materials, the contractor should reimburse the owner for the cost and expense for remediation or where the contractor fails to perform its job. So let's say a contractor for its work needs lime, a certain type of lime on the project, and it's stored in the container, the vat that they use. Well, if somehow that lime escapes and it contaminates the soil that was before proper, well, the contractor screwed up, they brought the lime, they were the ones that caused the lime to leach in. The owner's now going to have to pull out that soil, remediate that soil, and make it clean. And so in this instance, under 10.3.5, because it's the contractor's obligation, because it's their lime that they brought on, the contractor has to pay the owner for those costs and expenses. We need to worry about that. So any questions on hazardous materials? Think about it. If I brought it up to like the 10,000 foot level, what you want to think about it is, if it's in the land, it's owned by the owner and the owner's responsible. If it's in the drawings and requiring the contractor, the owner is responsible. If the contractor brings it to the land, the contractor's responsible. Now, the one thing that's not in these provisions, but the one kind of crossover that you want to remember is, let's say it's in the land, so you would think that the owner's responsible, and they should be. But if the contractor does not stop work and does not notify the owner, so they ignore their obligation to immediately stop work and notify, and the contractor exacerbates the situation, and then someone's injured, in that instance, both parties may be liable. Contractor, potentially by its exacerbation, may have to pay more because they created, the issue became worse. But the owner still has responsibilities. So I'll give you an example of that in a project I worked on. So there was a building that built in the 60s, early 60s. And for fire protection, they used to use asbestos. They had asbestos on the columns. They would spray it on, and that was how they kept the steel, the superstructure, from potentially melting down under high heat. During the course of a renovation, one of the early renovations of this building, they were pulling stuff off. And you shouldn't have asbestos anywhere. If you leave it in place and you don't fleck it out and make it what's called friable, it doesn't necessarily, by it sitting there static, asbestos by itself without being disturbed is not harmful to you. But little pieces that go in the air and everything else could harm you. So you don't really want it. And so a lot of these buildings will remediate and they will remove the asbestos by a certain way. Well, this contractor came in and was responsible for remediating the asbestos. So the owner owned the property. The owner knew the asbestos existed, and any issues as a result of that asbestos would be the responsibility of the owner. And in fact, so much so that the owner was paying a contractor, especially the asbestos removal contractor, to pay for that to be removed. So, but during the course of the work, the contractor screwed up and allowed some of that asbestos to release improperly. They didn't do the work correctly. And there were subsequent lawsuits brought by people who felt that they got asbestos poisoning from that. In that instance, the owner still had obligations and liabilities because It was their property and their asbestos. But the contractor also failed to do its job correctly. And so the contractor, too, was responsible in that instance. So there was this combined issuance there. So in most instances, if it's on the land, it's the owner's. If it's brought to the site, it's the contractor. But sometimes you can have this joint issue on hazardous materials. Okay. Insurance and bonds. I'm going to go through insurance pretty quickly because we've already talked about insurance. We had a whole section on insurance. I also am not the biggest fan of the AIA insurance provisions, but I'll just let you know what it says. We'll kind of flip through it to get through it because I'm not going to be, and I will not test you on the final under the A201 on anything related to insurance. Okay, so I'll just let you know where they, this is kind of a headline to see this is where they are. Since we already went through what types of insurance exist and how they work. So 1111 just says you got to, the contractor has to buy insurance. And the types of insurance that are listed. 1112 says if there's a bond, a surety bond, you may have to redo that as required by the contract. So it's just basically statements. You have to purchase insurance if it's required, and what listed is you have to purchase bonds if they're required. 1114, if your insurance is canceled, you need to give notice to the owner that there's cancellation and allow the owner to potentially come in and correct your insurance. So that's a situation where maybe the contractor failed to make premiums or whatever. Well, you at least want to have the ability for the owner to come in. I still want my project insured. So you give me notice that you're going to lose insurance, contractor. I, as the owner, will be able to make sure we cover that. We keep that umbrella over the project. 11.2, there's certain types of insurance the owner needs to retain. So 11.2.1 talks about what types of limits and stuff the owner has to retain. Property insurance is one. Notice the owner has to give cancellation, has to give notice that their property insurance is going to be, so the owner has to give notice to the contractor under 11.2.3. Waiver of subrogation is a concept that basically says, and we talked about this before, I have an insurance company and they may pay me for my loss. Not you, Art, contractor, you screwed up, contractor, but I have my own insurance. My insurance company pays me and now my insurance company is going to go after you, contractor. That's called subrogation. I'm subrogating my rights to the insurance company. Contractor doesn't want to defend against a multi-billion dollar insurance company. So this is a waiver. So both parties waive and they say, if we're going to be in a lawsuit against each other, it's owner versus contractor. It's never going to be insurance company versus the other one because it's just, it's just David and Goliath. So this waiver of subrogation concept is very common in the construction industry. You should have a mutual waiver of subrogation in virtually all of your construction contracts. And same way with the architect's agreement. This is pretty standard stuff. 11.4, loss of use, business interruption. So this would be potentially, this would be the concept of if we have that toy factory that's supposed to come online by August 1st so we can start making toys so we make sure we hit the Christmas season. This is talking about the owner may bring in their own loss of use and business. They may bring in their own insurance to cover that as opposed to suing the contractor for it. Those damages because I can't make my toys on time. Adjustments to settlement insurance also talks about how what happens if there's settlements made and if the subcontract or the insurance company makes payment. And then that's it. So I just wanted you to know what provisions are there. Again, you don't have to worry about being tested on it. All right, Article 12, uncovering and corrections of work. So some of the examples I've been giving you so far have been talking about what's behind a wall. You can't see behind a wall. Or when you're digging in soils, you don't know what's there. So there's going to be times during the course of a project that nobody has x-ray vision, and so they're not really sure what's there. And so how do you handle when you bid a project as a contractor and you're not sure, I don't really know exactly what's under the soil. And then you discover this radiated soil. What do you handle? How do you, in addition to stopping work, how do you handle it as far as change orders and payments? Or
what happens in correcting the work? Who corrects the work if there's a defect? So that's what Article 12 talks about, making sure that gaps or other problems, if there's a warranty, how do you fix that? Who's responsible for those types of things? So, or even if there's an inspection that needs to happen. So under 12.1, uncovering of work. Remember when I said there could be a situation where the architect is watching and sees in 1 month in their visit, they see the plumbing, and it looks good, but it's not finished. And they come back, and now the plumbing's all behind drywall. Well, the architect may want to see that plumbing work done. They may, maybe they said it looked good, but they were not quite secure in it. They've heard some things, whatever. So this talks about what do you do? So it says if the portion of the work is covered contrary to the architect's request or the requirements of the contract documents. Maybe the architect says, don't put up that drywall. I want to see it inspected. I want to bless it. Or even sometimes you have the city that has to come in and approve the installation of insulation, that it's properly put in place. All those things have to be blessed and approved prior to covering it up. If there's a request in writing by the architect, the contractor must uncover that for the architect's examination and be replaced at the contractor's expense without a charge, without a change in the contract time or contract sum. So if the architect says, don't put the drywall up, or the contract document says, don't cover that hole, when the architect comes back out and says, take the drywall off or dig open that hole, the contractor has to pay for it because they didn't follow the rules. That's 12.1.1. 12.1.2 says, if I didn't specifically say not to put the drywall up, or I didn't specifically say in the drawings not to cover that hole, I still can request to see that work, and I can still ask you to pull the drywall off. If it turns out that once I pull the drywall off, the plumbing is done incorrectly, the contractor pays for it. That's in 12.1.2. But if it's done correctly, let me see if that's here. No. There's another portion of the agreement. I thought it was in here, but there's another portion that it's done correctly, then the owner has to pay for it. So if the contractor says, if the architect says, pull off that drywall, I want to see the plumbing, and it's done right, then the owner has to pay the contractor for pulling off the drywall and putting it back up, which makes sense. So you want to, as the architect walking around the project site, you want to be careful before you start pulling off drywall. At the same time, you have an obligation to the owner, if you have suspicions, to make sure that the work was done correctly. So it's a balancing act that you have to go on experience and what the owner needs and wants and those types of things as to whether you require the work to be uncovered under 12.1.2. Correction of the work. So what happens if you do find it's defective? Well, who pays for it and when? And what's the situation? So if you remember, substantial completion is an important trigger date. So if there is work that's found out to be defective before substantial completion, the contractor has to correct it at its expense. And that's listed as defective work. So that's before substantial completion. That's 12.2.1. If 12.2.2, if it's after substantial completion, in that instance, if you remember, that's when the warranties kicked in. And substantial completion is after the architect has walked around the project site and basically says everything looks good. It looks like it was all done in accordance with the contract documents. So, presumably, the architect is blessing and saying there is no defective work, so I'm giving substantial completion certificate. But we all know things can happen that you can discover after substantial completion. So that becomes a warranty issue. And 12.2.2.1 creates this warranty period of a 1 year period after substantial completion that the contractor has to come back in and correct the work if the owner makes a breach of warranty claim. Now, if it's outside of that 1 year, the owner has waived its warranty claim. But within that 1 year period of time, contractor has to come back and fix things. Okay? So that's your warranty period. So this ties in with, I promised to give you a building that's new and in compliance with the documents. We did it. We got the substantial completion. We found something that was not proper afterwards. That pump stopped working, whatever it might be. Owner calls up the contractor. Your pump isn't working. We're under the warranty period. Come in and replace it. That's what happens under 12.221. 12.222, the 1 year period for construction work shall be expended with respect to portions of the work first performed after substantial completion by a period of time between substantial completion and the actual completion of that proportion of work. So what's that mean? What that means is we get to the contractor calls up the architect and says, hey, I'm substantially complete. Come out and take a look at everything. And architect says, okay, I'll take a look at it. It's the middle of the summer. Wanders around and realizes that there's some problems with the furnace. Well, we don't need the furnace in that period of time. So says, all right, I'll give you substantial completion, but you have to fix X, Y, and Z on the furnace. So they fix it, and if substantial completion was June 30th, but they don't come in and fix that furnace until September, October. They say, well, we can't fix it because we won't be running it. We need to run it when it's a little bit colder. We need to see how this issue works. So we're going to come back and fix it in October. So once they fix it in October for the furnace, that one-year warranty period is extended from June 30th to the date they fix it. So effectively, you want to think about it as the 12-month period starts of when they complete or correct the work that was done after substantial completion. So it was defective before, architect saw it, architect pointed it out, fixed after substantial completion, so the warranty extends for that additional period. So that's 12.222. 12.24, contractor shall bear costs of correcting destroyed or damaged construction by the owner, owner, separate contractor, whether completed or partially completed, caused by the contractor's correction or the removal of the work. So let's say contractor has to fix something and it damages while it's doing post-completion work or whatever. So something the owner or the owner separate contractor has put in. That kitchen's nice, it's been put in, everything's fine. If the contractor's doing corrective work on something else and damages the work by the separate contractor or the owner, the contractor has to pay for or fix what it damaged. Kind of makes sense. Because the contractor is going to say, it's not my warranty, it's not my work, so that defect isn't mine, it's yours. Your contractor did that. And the owner's going to look back and say, yeah, but you were the one that caused the defect when you were doing your work. You were the one that caused it. That's 12.24. 12.25 is a statute of limitations period, but it highlights the one-year period of correction of work, your one-year warranty. There may be some warranties that are longer, like a roof would be 5, 10, or 20 years or something. There are other ones that could have extended, but the traditional period for warranty is for the work done is for 1 year. And then 12.3, acceptance of non-conforming work. Sometimes the owner can say, you know what? Yeah, that refrigerator has a ding or a dent in it, or there's something wrong with the way you did this. You know, maybe the countertop was not placed correctly. But I don't want to wait. I'm going to move in. Well, 12.3 says I can accept that defective work. It's not in accordance with the contract documents, and I will accept it. But you need to give me a reduction. You need to give me a credit for that. That's equitable to whatever I'm accepting. You know, if that countertop is not completely straight, but I'll accept it, I need 10% off that price. And that's a negotiation that will happen. But contractually, it allows the owner to accept defective work from the contractor. Any questions overall on defective work? Okay. Article 13 has some miscellaneous provisions that just talks about if you're going to go into arbitration, you've got to go into the Federal Arbitration Act under 13.1. 13.2 talks about assignment and excesses and assigns. We don't have to worry about that for the exam because you guys have already done assignments. We talked about that in the past. This is a saving clause under 13.3.2. No action or failure to act by the owner, architect, or contractor shall constitute a waiver of a right or duty afforded them under the contract. So just because you paid, I'm not waiving my claim against you for defective work. Just because I did something else, an action doesn't constitute a waiver. Waiver only occurs when the contract says you've waived it or failed to do something that could potentially result in a waiver. 13.4 just talks about how tests and inspections are performed. 13.4.2, if the architect, owner, or public authorities having jurisdiction determine that portions of the work require testing, that may be and should be paid for at the owner's expense under 13.4.2. However, such procedures for testing are appropriate under 13.4.1 and 13.4.2 reveal failure of the portions of the work to comply with the requirements established, then those should be the contractor's expense. So if I want to have a specialty test come in, you know, I want to make sure that the fire protection system is properly charged and pressurized. Or if I want to make sure that, I'm trying to think what else may happen, but some other specialty test that I want to have happen, owner, if it's not in the contract documents and everything else, owner pays. But upon performing that, if there's not, if the system fails, if the test is a failure, the contractor has to pay for correction of that failure and pay for the additional test to make sure that it's working properly. So all that is logical, but it's in writing. You don't want to get into a squabble about who pays for the test when. That's why it's in here. But if I come in and I test and it fails, you pay for a contractor, otherwise I pay for it. For my peace of mind. And that's all you need to know, those sections under Article 13. All right, we got about 15 minutes left, 10 minutes left, and we're going to get through Article 14 and 15. So this is important. Article 14 is termination, and then Article 15 is claims. So what I'm going to go through is that 14.1 talks about termination, that the contractor actually can terminate this contract. They can walk away for certain reasons. If the court requires that the work is stopped more than 30 days, contractor can terminate. If the government has brought in a national emergency, contractor and requires that work be stopped, the government can terminate. If the architect hasn't properly certified payment, or the owner hasn't made payment and everything else, the contractor can terminate. So these are important reasons why the contractor can terminate. As a side, I changed this to suspend, and the only reason why I believe, and this is something you want to, as an architect, tell the owner, that it's not in the contract, I believe the only reason why a contractor should be able to terminate a contractor is for failure to payment. They can stop work and get paid for the stop of work, but I really believe it only should be for failure of payment. But the AIA has a little bit more beef, a little more protection for the contractor. If any of these four items happen, contractor can terminate. Contractor also gets their repeated suspensions. So if they suspend the project, but it's not 30 days, and if it is more than 120 days in aggregate, or in a 365-day period, or if it's more than 100% of the total number of days scheduled, so lots of them, so there's like 10 days here, 15 days here, 30 days there, and it turns out you're only in a 45-day schedule, when you get to 45 days, if we keep bouncing things out, that's another reason why the contractor could terminate under the AIA. 14.1.3 says you need to give your 7 days notice of the termination, so provide notice after 7 days that you're going to terminate. And that gives the owner the chance to cure. If there's a problem with payment or otherwise, and you get notice within 7 days before the contractor terminates, the owner has the opportunity to cure. Another one here, this is about period of
There's a suspension. Hold on a second. No, this is another one. So this is if the work is stopped for 60 consecutive days and it's not the fault of the contractor. The contractor, again, on 7 days can terminate and recover under this provision. So there's sections, different times. Again, all these lists of why you can terminate a contract. On the owner side, the owner can terminate. So if you want to, let me go one back. All of these provisions are specific causes that they have to have one of these events occur. They can't just walk away because they don't feel like working on the project. If they did that, that's a breach. But if any one of these previously identified delays or payment issues or certification issues, if those occur, that's called termination for cause. And that's the only time a contractor can terminate is for cause. The owner has termination for cause, but there's also provision coming up for termination for convenience. So here, they can terminate for cause if the contractor hasn't supplied enough properly skilled workers, if they failed to pay the subcontractors, if they disregard the laws, ordinances, and statutes, or they're guilty of substantial breach of a provision of the contract document. So some specific breach, maybe one scope of work they did terribly, it's enough that that's a breach of the contract. It's because the contract documents include the drawings. So that may be sufficient. Just they failed to perform the plumbing correctly. That may be substantially enough to justify termination for cause. The owner has that right. What the owner also has to do, though, before they actually file the termination, it needs to be certified by the initial decision maker. In that case, it could be the architect or it could be somebody else, that sufficient cause exists to justify this action. So the owner can't say 1 through 4 here in 14.2.1, one of these happens, I get to terminate. What happens is if 14.2.1, if one of these four items occurs, then 14.2.2 kicks in, and the owner has to go to the initial decision maker to justify, so they do their inspection, and they certify termination. And upon certifying of termination, there's seven days of written notice, then you can terminate. And upon termination, after that 7 days, they can exclude the contractor from the site, they can pick up the contracts by subcontracts by assignment, they can finish the work. So there's a list of things that the owner can do if they kick the contractor off the project site. As a quick aside, this certification by the initial decision maker, the architect, confirming that the items under 4.2.1 happened is key. If the owner goes ahead and terminates without the certification, even if the owner was correct and one of those four items occurred, the owner is in breach of contract. And I had that very case. I went to trial on that case. There was problems with the contract. We were the contractor. There was problems and they were delayed. They had some other issues with payments. There was arguably justifiable reasons for the owner to terminate. And the owner did. But the owner did not bring in the engineer to certify termination. And we fought it for 3 years and finally went to a three-week trial. And at the end of the trial, we won based on this failure to certify. So this is something that you will potentially be brought in as the architect on certification, and this is very important for you to remember. Don't let your owner terminate without complying with 14.2.2. Okay? That's really, really important. Because then, in that instance, we got paid $2 million. They were claiming $8 million from us, and we got paid almost $2 million, like $1.8 million, because they owed us money from the rest of the project. And they didn't pay us. So we got our money and they got none, even though there was probably a decent argument that we hadn't completed our work properly, but they didn't follow this one provision was enough. So, 14.2.4 talks about how payment is. This is, and I'm not going to test you on this because you guys have already had this. 14.2.4 talks about expectation damages. It says, if the cost of the contract exceeds the cost to finish the work, then that excess shall be paid to the contractor. Meaning, if I thought you were going to do it for $10 million, and there was $2 million left in the contract, and I only had to pay $1.5 million to finish it. I had promised you originally, contractor, $2 million. So that delta, that $500,000, because the unpaid balance, $2 million, exceeds what it cost to finish, because of the expectation the contractor gets that $500,000. If the cost exceeds the unpaid balance, the $2 million is left and it costs $2.5 million, the contractor has to pay it because of the expectation damages. So I'm not going to quiz you on that, but I want you to see here's an expectation damage clause in works right there in the contract of exactly how it's supposed to work. 14.3 talks about suspension. So the owner can suspend the contract. It doesn't have to terminate. It can stop it for various reasons. And it says that they suspend due to delay to interrupt as the owner may determine. It doesn't have a reason why. It just says we can suspend without cause, just because we want to. If it's suspended, then it goes through 14.3.2 that the contract sum and time are adjusted. If the contractor has to sit around, the contractor didn't do anything wrong, and the owner suspended, the contractor should pay for the contractor should be paid for the time it's sitting around. I have to pay my workers to be on hold. I have to pay for storage of materials. I've got my trailer on the site. All those costs to during the owner suspension need to be paid to the owner based on 14.3.2 if it was suspension without cause. And then finally, 14.4 talks about termination of the owner by convenience. So here, the owner can terminate just because they don't like the contractor's color of their car. Who cares? They can terminate the contractor for convenience and without cause at any time. I can just walk away. And this sometimes happens where you're on a project where things aren't going right and you don't trust the contractor anymore. But you may not be on completely stable grounds for termination for cause. And that may cause a huge fight and litigation and everything else. And so what you do is you as the owner make the decision. Contractor's a bad apple. I don't want to pay my lawyers. I don't want to be in a lawsuit for the next 5 years. I'm going to terminate for convenience just because I can. And I'm going to tell them to stop operations. I'm going to come over and take over the work. I'm going to get rid of the existing subcontracts. All these things that I'm able to do and the contractor has to do. But upon termination for convenience under 14.4.3, the owner shall pay the contractor for work properly executed, including costs for termination and costs attributable to termination of the subcontract. So there's this termination fee. There could be cost incurred. So the owner makes an election. Instead of terminating the contractor for cause and getting in litigation fights for the next 5 years and $1 million in legal fees, I'll pay the contractor and terminate him for convenience, and I'll write him a check for $200,000. This is how much it's going to cost you to get out of your subcontracts and demobilize and whatever else it is. So I will pay you under 14.4.3 to walk away without litigation. And sometimes I've advised my owners to do this. Let's not fight it. Let's get out from under this. But you're going to have to pay to get out from under it. So that's termination for convenience. Contractor does not have that. Only the owner has termination for convenience rights. That it costs them. Okay? Last section, claims and disputes. So if you remember going back, every once in a while it says if the owner, when we talk about change orders or other things, it said if the contractor doesn't agree, they can file a claim under Article 15, or the owner can file a claim under Article 15. So this is the last article of the contract that talks about claims and disputes. So you have a definition of the claim. It's a demand or assertion by one of the parties, so either one can make it, for a payment of money, change in contract time, or other such relief. And so the terms also include other disputes and matters arising between owner and contractor relating to the contract. So a claim could deal with indemnity. It could be a warranty claim. So a warranty claim is come back and fix my warranty item. It's not for money or time. It just says come back and make a claim, come back and do it. So claims kind of have a large umbrella of what happens. Responsibility substantiate the claim, rest of the party making it. So if you're making the claim, you have to prove why you're entitled to the other side to perform what they need to perform. That's 15.1.1. 15.1.2,
They need to commence all claims and cause of actions against each other within the period specified by law, or in any case not more than 10 years after the date of substantial completion. So this is saying, if the law talks about statutes of limitations, we've talked about that before, that's what 15.1.2 says. The claim that you have to do it, and if you fail to do it within those periods of times, you waive all these claims. So you got to make sure you hit your dates. Just as an aside, we filed a lawsuit yesterday, but we had to file it because we were coming up against a statute of limitations, and this contract provision obligated us to do that because it's an AAA contract. So the statute of limitations is actually running on Sunday, so we filed it yesterday. 15.1.3, once there's a claim that comes in, it goes to what's called this initial decision maker. Could be the architect, could be somebody else. It's the first level of analysis. So the initial decision maker comes in and does an analysis to see which party's right. You know, like the contractor has a beef against the owner. The owner comes back and says, all right, let's bring the initial decision maker to see who's right or who's wrong. So they do that first analysis under 15.1.3.1. And it needs to be made after it's first discovered, after the expiration period of the correction of the work. So you got to make sure you give it within the right period of time, and you have to give notice under 15.1.3. 15.1.4.1 is if there's a claim that's going on and there's a dispute over something, that doesn't mean the work should stop. 15.4.1 says, even though there's a claim, contractor has to continue performing on the contract and the owner has to continue paying payments. So you kind of take that dispute and you park it on the side. And you go ahead and everything else continues along, and we all agree to disagree on the claim, but we all agree to continue to do work and pay for the work being performed. And that's so the one claim doesn't stop the entire project. That's 15.1.4.1. And if there's claims for additional cost, the contractor needs to give notice of that before proceeding to go and perform the work. So let's say the contractor says, hey, your drawings say I'm supposed to build this wall a certain way. It's going to cost more money, and the reason why it's going to cost more money is because the architect's drawings were incorrect that I bid off of. So the contractor needs to submit that claim, and if it starts working on the wall and comes back later and did not submit a claim for that additional cost, then they failed to make it here. So they've waived their chance to make a claim for money. So if you are a contractor, and if it's going to cost more money due to a screw-up by the architect to build something, don't start the work until you make a claim. That's claim for additional costs. Claim for additional time, they need to give an estimate of the cost and effect of the delay, so they have to give information about how much the contract time is going to be extended. If there's weather, that's 15.1.6.1. If there's weather conditions, they need to show why their schedule didn't include those in the contract. So, you know, if you're building a building in Chicago and you know you're going to be working in December, January, and February, you know you're going to have winter weather. So you can't pretend that you thought you would be working every single day of that month. You have to have a schedule that takes those into account. So you have to substantiate your request for additional schedule because the weather was worse than anticipated. So that's what 15.1.6.2 does. It protects the owner for a contractor that says, oh, there was a little bit of rain today. I didn't think it might rain in the month of September, so I should get a day extension. That doesn't fly, because it rains in September. Claims for consequential damages. This is a waiver by both parties. And these are damages that have nothing to do with the actual work, that has to potentially do like lost profits or loss of use, and that's why we have that loss of use insurance we talked about. The waiver of consequential damages are important. So the contractor, when it's late on delivering to me my toy factory, doesn't pay me for all of my loss of sales of the toys. It pays me for certain delay damages relating to other elements, and maybe we could do that as a liquidated damage or otherwise. But my loss of business is waived because that's a consequence of their delay, not an actual construction and direct cost. So there's a waiver of consequential damages by both parties here. Same thing, like, let's say that the project is delayed because the owner has changes. And the contractor says, well, I thought I was going to get the next project for somebody else. I lost $1 million fee on this next project because your project went overwards. Well, yes, the delay kept that team from bidding on the new project, but that's a consequential loss, and the owner would not be required to pay that $1 million the contractor claims it lost, because it would be a consequence, not a direct damage. I'm not going to go into this too much. I just talk just so you guys should know, and I want to test you on this exam, but I want to highlight since we're running out of time. 15.2 talks a little bit more about the job that the initial decision maker has. It receives it. It has to make it its decision before mediation. The initial decision maker has to make it within 30 days. So these are elements of what happens once you get your initial decision request via the architect. And then upon receipt of it within 10 days, they have to go through a bunch of information and get from the parties to be able to resolve the claim. They have to reject it in whole or part or whatever they need to do to get additional data. And it continues on to provide, sometimes it may have to be in writing. They can get special knowledge or expertise. They can bring in an expert to help them make the decision. So again, elements of what the initial decision maker can do, kind of acting as a mini trial, but they don't have any authority to impose their decision on you. It just happens first before mediation. And then after the decision comes in for the initial decision making, if the decision comes in, either party can file for mediation, which is a non-binding dispute resolution process. And then that's what talks about in the rest of the contract. There's provisions under 15.3 that goes through mediation. The parties can mediate a dispute between each other under 15.3.2 under the American Arbitration Association rules. Talks about how long it takes for mediation under 15.3.3 and 15.3.4. And then if you can't solve the dispute by mediation, this agreement allows for arbitration. And if you remember from our discussions early on in the semester, mediation is a non-binding dispute resolution. You have a third party that comes in and tells you what he believes or she believes will be the answer and where the dispute will land, but neither party has to accept it. Arbitration is like litigation. It is binding, but it doesn't have a judge and jury, so it has a little bit different flavor to it. And so this gives a process by which if the parties go to arbitration, it walks through that process under Article 15.4. And then the last part of this is this consolidation or joinder provision. And this allows, if I have a dispute and I'm the owner, and I have claims that there was an architect or design defect, and then under the other contract with the contractor, I have a claim that there's a construction defect, this provision allows me to bring both parties, architect and contractor, to the same arbitration, so I don't have to have two pending at the same time. I can join them together. And that is all we have. I know this is a lot. What I'll do is when we get closer to the exam, I'm going to highlight and walk through the more important provisions that you'll want to look for under this document for the exam. Like I said, I'm not going to test you on insurance. I'm not going to test you on the mediation arbitration provisions because we talked about that. Some of the other elements, but I'll make sure when we go through the review prior to the exam, the last day of class, to go through and say, pay attention to Article 3, Article 5, Article 2, whatever they might be. Okay, so I went a little bit over. And I will see you guys. Any questions? Okay, I'll see you guys next week.